Hi, everybody. Hello. What's going on? Welcome to the program. It's the Jeff Gerstmann Show. We're here. It is November 22nd. That means it's Thanksgiving week. That means if your video game's not out this week, then it doesn't matter. Right? That's traditionally how that usually goes, you know. That was always the way, you know, that was the release season was from like late August until basically this week. And this week was always kind of cutting it close. If you were shipping your game on the, you know, the 22nd, 23rd, around there, like a couple days before Thanksgiving, you were really cutting it close. But you were getting your game out on shelves just in time for Black Friday, and that was the goal, right? Is they always wanted to be right there when that shopping season started. And now, I don't know, everything is so different now, you know, because this is stuff that dates back to before online shopping was really a thing, you know, and then for years, online shopping, of course, was still a thing, but this all still happened. And I don't know if it doesn't seem to quite happen the same way. Some of that, I'm sure, is just kind of the, that kind of pandemic effect on game shipping dates and consumer patterns and all this other stuff, really messing up the last few years quite a bit. But at the end of the day, you know, I think there still is that push to, you know, if you're shipping a big game, you want to get it out so that it's on shelves whenever the Black Friday stuff happens, or at least Cyber Monday. But I guess as we shift further and further into digital sales, like that whole end just doesn't matter anymore, you know, and games are selling year round, but there still is that kind of Q4, like, oh, there's a little bit of holiday money floating around that a lot of companies would love to suck up. But also it feels like everyone's sale has already started. I am not a deals man. I am not out there getting around and going, where are the hottest deals? But it does seem like everyone has launched all of their stuff, like getting emails from Sony about our Black Friday sale started, and I think Microsoft started theirs as well. I don't know what Nintendo was doing. And then Steam is doing its thing pretty soon here too, if they haven't already started. Is it today that's, I don't know. Starting very soon, I'm sure, if it hasn't already started. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I'm not really looking for much of anything. You know, obviously in the video game realm, I tend to not be looking for stuff. Like I'm in contact with game publishers, and you know, I will get codes for games and access to games in a variety of ways. So game sales are not, you know, something I'm immediately interested in. But when it comes to the other stuff, like for years, I've not been like we've got to get up at 3 a.m. and get the doorbuster deals on. Just none of the deals ever felt good. All these like Amazon sale days and all this stuff. And you go there and you're like, what do you got? What's your best deal? And it's like, we got these Alexa speakers cheap, bro. And you're like, cool, man. Fuck all that. Fuck those things. And I guess like Amazon agrees, they're laying off like a lot of people across the company. And it sounds like one of the departments that has taken kind of one of the early hits has been the device group responsible for Alexa. It just seems like that whole smart speaker thing, I thought that was going to be a big deal. I had big dreams. I had a huge idea that would take a lot of work and probably not earn any money. But I had what I still think it would be awesome. It just would take so much work to do that it wouldn't make a lot of sense. And I think that's a lot of the smart speaker stuff, is there's a lot of like, oh, there's some neat ideas, but like none of them make anyone any money. And why are we doing this? And all people only use those things to find out what the weather is. And they've got phones that do that. So, you know, maybe they don't need a speaker listening to them in the home all the time, when we already have phones and all that sort of stuff. What I wanted to do, the idea that I, you know, that I said out loud a few times, it was never like a pitch deck or anything like that, because it was not my product to pitch. Here's what they should do. If these fuckers, you guys are listening, and I know you are, take the GameFAQs data, take every fact on GameFAQs, machine learn the shit out of that. This is a really hard thing to do, by the way. This is a super hard, this is not a good solvable fucking problem. This is a shitty. What I want to be able to do is when I'm playing a game and when I am stuck in the game, I want to be able to say, hey, Alexa, what the fuck do I do now? And have it tell me. So, in so many words, right? Like, I want it to be able to figure out where I am in the game. I want to, you know, like all the stuff. So the number of services you would have to tie together to make all of that work and then have like the fact at the end that it could read out and be like, you need to go get the fucking, the mace of fucking Malbolga and then club somebody with it, you know, whatever it is. You would have to massage the data into bite-sized chunks, which it is not. You would have to, it is a mountain of a problem. But if you're thinking about what would be cool to do with a smart speaker, that would be it. As far as I got was like, well, you would have to figure out where you are in the game, right? It would have to know, the speaker would have to be tied into the game somehow, and it would need to know how. So either you are then doing a deal with Microsoft and Sony and everybody to like give some data about where you are in the game, and Sony would not do this, especially because now that they're trying to do that themselves as a PlayStation Plus thing, like they would probably never do it. But I started thinking, like, well, what if every video game emitted a little tiny tone that the Alexa could hear that human hearing could not? Again, this is a long, insane fucking scheme. As I tried to think about, like, what's the easiest way you want? Because you want the user to be able to say, what do I do next? So the game emits different unhearable tones based on where you are in the game. So as you go through the game, that tone changes. And the smart speaker can hear it. So when you say, what do I do next? It hears that. It knows what game you're playing, where you are, maybe some other details about your game, depending on how complicated the audio piece could be. And then it goes and figures out what you're doing, where you are, all that other stuff, and it tries to read out meaningful data about what you should be doing next. Simple, right? I can't believe that as I tried to pitch this incredibly streamlined, easy to understand plan, that the multiple people that I gave it to didn't go like, yes, we're going to start on this tomorrow. Here's your corner office, dumbass. Yeah, but I don't know. That was the only cool thing I ever thought that could be done with those things. Other than just like the, you know, was there room for like, some of these speakers will do like your morning news, your morning briefing, your morning whatever. And it was like, oh, there should probably be one of those about games. You could do a 1 minute morning thing about, and this was when I was doing a 1 minute thing for radio every week. And yeah, I don't know. You could do something like that, but yeah, I don't know. The whole smart speaker thing just seems. I got one as a wedding present. I asked for one as a wedding present and got one and set it up for a while and tried using it and tried integrating it into my life a little bit and was just like, this doesn't, I'm just not using this. And I don't like the idea of it, you know, potentially listening to everything and all this other stuff. So I eventually got rid of it, but yeah, I don't know. That's, you know, now we're in sales season, so I'm sure that, you know, you'll get inundated with like, this smart speaker's like deep discount because we're trying to blow them out because they suck as a business, it turns out. Also on the shopping tip here before we get going, man. Oh, you know, it's fine. For the PlayStation VR 2, they did a thing where they wanted you to go to their website and say, yes, I would like to potentially pre-order a PlayStation VR 2. And whenever game hardware comes out, I always try to pre-order one and buy one. I often do receive console hardware and stuff like that from companies directly. But you never know, especially with some of this stuff that seems like it's going to be hard to come by. And also, you just never know. So you're like, okay, well, I want to make sure I'm covered either way. So I should definitely order one. So I went through and clicked on the button that said, yes, I would like to pre-order a PlayStation VR 2. And then I guess I got picked, but the email ended up going to some other folder and not sending any notifications and basically got buried. And I found it over the weekend, 2 days after the opportunity had closed. And, you know, so I clicked the button saying like, yes, I would like to buy one. And I was like, you should have done this 2 days ago, dumbass. And I was like, word. So I missed out on my opportunity to pre-order a PlayStation VR 2. I'm curious about anyone in either of the chats. We're on Discord, if you're part of the Patreon, over at patreon.com/Jeff Gerstmann. Or if you are in the Twitch chat while we're live, I'm kind of curious if you if anyone actually pre-ordered a PlayStation VR 2 or... Yeah, Rec Roulette says had the opportunity but did not. Yeah. John registered but wasn't sure if you wanted to pay $550 and then didn't get picked, so it didn't matter. Yeah. And Bowles got the Horizon bundle. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Got the email 3 times but did not get it. Yeah, I started getting emails. I stopped looking at the emails because I also started getting emails from Sony saying, like, you should register. And I was like, well, I've already registered, so... So I don't know, there's going to be some far-flung future when they take these orders. I didn't know when the orders were opening up, so I didn't even know when to be looking for it or anything like that, and missed my window, which is, I guess, okay. I guess that's okay. I don't know. Again, it is still VR stuff, and I'm still very... Well, whatever. We've talked about VR enough. We've beat up on VR enough. I had to, speaking of VR, I had a young relative of mine had a birthday, and I wanted to get him a gift card. He is interested in video games and VR and video games where you can make stuff. He was a big Roblox guy, and I think he still is quite a big Roblox guy. But I got him a Roblox gift card last year, so I thought, let's get something else. And he plays a lot of Rec Room. I'm like, well, I'm going to go buy a Rec Room gift card. And yeah, that'll be good. Filled it all out. Next day, got an email back. Nah, we've rejected your credit card. I'm like, okay, that's stupid. And then went and filled it out again with another credit card. And then shortly after that, got another email saying, no, this credit card, no. I'm like, okay, well... I guess we're not taking credit cards for Rec Room gift cards, so that's not going to work. And so, like, well, I guess I could go with a Oculus. He's got a Quest 2. Like, I could go with an Oculus Store credit, Oculus Store gift card. They have those. So I tried to log into their store, and it came up, and it said, you got to migrate your account to our new thing. We got this whole new thing. You should migrate your account. Let's make it happen. Let's start migrating. By the way, if you haven't updated the firmware and started this migration on your Quest 2, it's going to wipe out a lot of stuff off of your Quest 2. And I was like, okay. Well, I don't want to have that happen because I don't want to have to wipe my Quest 2. Is that going to, am I going to lose my purchases? Probably not, but it's like, okay. So I dug out my Quest 2, plugged it in, let it charge because it was completely dead, got it up because it has to be over 50% before you can update the firmware. You turn it on and it's like, you need to update your firmware because this account stuff doesn't do it like this anymore. I'm like, no, I understand. That's why I'm here. Fuckface. Let it go through its whole thing. And then updated the firmware on it. And then after that, it did a series of like, okay, now take the headset off and go to this website and type in this 8-character code. And I'm like, yes, but the 8-character code is on the fucking headset. So I'm sitting here with a web browser in the dark because it's late, and I'm putting on the headset going like 8, Y, okay, B, okay, all right, 8, and going through those hoops to finally connect the thing to the new account, which is still my fucking Facebook account anyway, because it's like, it's a new account. Do you want to log in with Facebook? I'm like, yes, because fuck this. You're all Facebook. Like, you're like, oh, we don't require a Facebook account to log into this stuff. It's still fucking Facebook. Change the fucking name of it all you want. You are still fucking, it's still fucking Mark Zuckerberg's fucking leaky fridge full of fucking login details. It's the same fucking thing. Like, oh, this is totally different. We hear you that you don't want to have a Facebook login to use the thing. So we've created the new Meta login stuff. I'm like, okay. But like, I've already merged my old Oculus account away into my Facebook account. So you already know that this is me on Facebook. Like, it's not. So yes, just yes. I'll just log in with my fucking Facebook details. Fuck off. I'm not going to create another login and password for Meta. Like, yeah, sure. Just let me click these buttons and do this thing. 45 minutes it took me of jumping through fucking hoops. I had to go replace the batteries in the fucking, in the hand controllers. They were long dead. Get through all this. Get the firmware updated. Then set it aside. Turn it off. Because that part's done. And then when I went to the web store, it was like, all right, cool. Do you want to buy a gift card? I'm like, yes. I would like to buy a gift card. I'm sure that there was some backdoor way for me to buy a gift card without an account or do something. Do something. If I had dug a little bit deeper. Instead, it took me 45 minutes of updating firmwares and replacing batteries and taking the headset on and off and all the stuff to buy a gift card on their website. And yeah. So anyway, he got his gift card. And then I bought the gift card. And it's late in the evening, you know, on his actual birthday at this point, because the rec room thing went so sideways. And he hasn't gotten it yet. And I'm like, all right, well, what the fuck? And I go and track the order, and it's like, we've received your order, but it hasn't shipped yet. I'm like, motherfucker, it's an email. Send the email. A few hours later, it went through. He got it. It's done. I believe he purchased a Five Nights at Freddy's something. Something. Why don't we take a break? We'll come back. We'll talk about a couple of video games and, you know, and then the news and all this other stuff. On with the show, as they say. We'll be back after this. What are you thankful for this holiday season? Is it the sanctity and security of your personal data? Well, then, why not add to that security stack? Why not add to that holiday feeling of snugness and warmth with the power of Backblaze? Backblaze is unlimited backup of your computer for just $7 a month. That means if you've got a Mac or a PC, you install the Backblaze software, and it takes care of the rest. It'll back up your docs. What, you know, you got music, you got photos, you got videos, drawings, projects, all of your data backed up securely in their facility outside of your house. You know, hey, what if your house burns down? What if a meteor strike? You know, with something crazy, your data is secure somewhere else. So if anything happens to your computer, I mean, anything really, I mean, you know, if it gets smashed with a brick or someone steals it, or I don't know, it catches on fire, you know, whatever, you kick it to death, you know, anything that happens, even just natural hard drive failure, which is, you know, what's happened to me on multiple occasions. All your data is there with Backblaze. You can log in via their web app, select which files you want back. It will zip them up and let you download them directly. Or, hey, if you're restoring a whole F-ton of data, they'll send you a hard drive. You know, they'll just send you a hard drive with your data on it. You send it back to them within 30 days to get a full refund for the hard drive, all that other stuff. You know, no weird stuff in the middle there for the extra charges, all that other stuff. But, hey, do you accidentally delete stuff? Do you want some extra retention history? You can extend that to a full year for an extra $2 a month. Backblaze has restored over 55 billion files. And thousands of those are mine. Like, I have had... One hard drive had smoke coming out of it because I'm an idiot and I did something. I hooked it up bad when I was moving from one computer to another. That one's on me. I had another one that was a brand new drive that just decided it was done working. I've had years old drives that were just like, hey, you know what? We're super done. It takes all kinds of hard drives for you to realize, man, it's a good thing that I can just log into Backblaze and get all this stuff back on my own. Easy peasy, and just make all that happen. It's super useful. Even if you're somewhere else and you're like, oh man, I need to get hold of this file, and I don't have any weird remote access set up, you can still log into Backblaze and get that stuff anyway. You don't have to lose a hard drive to take advantage of the power of Backblaze. Head over to backblaze.com/Jeff and take advantage of their fully featured 15-day, no credit card required free trial. Just head over there, set it up, install it, fool around with the software. It's got a few options there. If you want it to, you know, back up during certain hours or just go all the time, depending on your bandwidth situation, all that sort of stuff. You can mess around with that and see what you like. But yeah, go play around with it. See how it goes. And then, you know, rest easy, securely, knowing that, you know, no matter how much data you've got in that Windows or Mac PC, you know, you can fill it full of hard drives and just forget it and just let Backblaze take care of the rest. It's nice. Anyway, they're listed on the NASDAQ stock exchange under BLCE. Backblaze is committed more than ever to bringing easy and affordable data storage that you can trust. So don't be the guy that forgot to back up your important files. Backblaze has your back. Sign up for a 15-day free trial right now. No credit card required when you sign up over at backblaze.com/Jeff. That's Backblaze, $7 a month, and then rest easy. All right, we're back. Why don't we talk about some video games? So, gosh, I'm trying to think what has happened since we last spoke. I have been playing more of the kind of Warzone and DMZ modes of Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2. And they're fascinating. There's a lot going on there. I turned voice chat on in that game. I play at night, so I can't speak because I often have a child sleeping behind me here. He's still sleeping down here. We're gonna move him to his room pretty soon. And then I can curse at people on the internet. Anyway, the new modes kind of rolled out and they're really interesting. DMZ is so not it's not the standard Call of Duty mode. It feels like a very different thing. My first reaction to it is that it just felt incredibly out of place. Like, it was just like, this doesn't seem like something that really makes a lot of sense in this package compared to Warzone and the kind of standard competitive multiplayer and the standard co-op stuff like that. DMZ is weirdly aimless, and you kind of get out of it what you put into it, and And there are just a lot of things to find when you drop into the zone in DMZ mode. It's the same map as that they use for Warzone. You get, I think it's a 3-person squad. I usually go in alone because I'm an idiot and that's not a great way to play it. But since I'm not on voice chat, it seems like something that I haven't really wanted to do too much of. But now that I've turned voice chat back on and I can at least hear other people, I may start squatting up. Or I may at least squat up with some of the folks on the Discord. We were talking about that last night because there's stuff to get in the DMZ mode that will unlock in all the other modes. Namely, there's a gun, like a specific gun, that right now the only way you can get it is to get it off a dude's body in the DMZ. And so when you start, it just puts you in your squad at a random place in the map, and then it's like, all right, man, go. It's not going to close in on you like Warzone or anything like that. You've got a variety of mission objectives that you can kind of pull as you're going in. And these will kind of, these almost at the early going feel like tutorials trying to show you what you can do, because you'll find keys and key cards and different things that you can basically use to unlock doors at other parts of the level. There's a weapon case that you can pick up. And then there's the chemist, who's a guy walking around. There's a small radioactive zone on the map. And then somewhere in that zone is a dude dressed up in a big old biohazard suit. And he is holding a very specific gun. And so you can kill him and you can take his gun. The catch is, you only get to keep this stuff if you extract with it. If you die in the zone, you lose all of that. And also, if you brought certain types of guns in with you, you lose those too. So it gives it a kind of stakes that Call of Duty certainly just does not have in any other way. They're pretty light stakes all told, because it's just like, oh no, this shotgun with a single attachment on it is gone. Whatever will I do? You know, like, but if you eventually get down to a point where you have lost a lot and you have no guns, then you have no guns. What they do give you is something called an insured slot, and you can take one of your other multiplayer loadout weapons, one of your other traditional unlocked weapons, and you can put that into your insured slot. So if you die and you've got one of your insured slot weapons, what it does is it locks that slot for 2 hours. So you can't use that, and you bring that gun in with you. So if you just get in there and die over and over again, you just fucking lose a bunch of stuff. So basically, I got to a point where I was like, okay, well, I have to go into the zone with a throwing knife and fucking stab the first dude I see and take his gun so that I've got a gun and go from there. And it's interesting. The AI is really hard isn't the word. But they don't go down easily. They are tougher than the AI in the invasion mode, I would say. They're usually armored, or they armor up pretty quickly. And they are AI. They know where you are, they know where you're going, all that sort of stuff. It's not, they aren't trying to act human. Instead, they're just like, oh, okay, we're gonna swarm you and fuck you up. And then you're done. And you're like, well, I guess I lost all my guns and all this other stuff. It's goofy. It's a really silly fucking mode, but I want that gun. I want the chemist's gun. God damn it. And so I've been seeing videos. TikTok is rotten with, and this is all it's serving me now, because I've engaged with it often enough that it's like, oh, you want to watch more Call of Duty videos? I'm like, I kind of don't, but like, all right. So what people are doing, and what I'm trying to do, and I've been completely unsuccessful at, is going in alone, getting in an armored vehicle, driving straight to the chemist, running that motherfucker over, getting out, grabbing his gun, getting back in the vehicle, and driving to an extraction point. Sounds easy. It's not. I keep dying. Like, I can run that motherfucker over real well. I can kill the chemist like nobody's business. I run that guy down. It's no problem. But he's surrounded by a bunch of guys. So as soon as you're taking fire, you're getting shot while you're in the vehicle. You're jumping out while you're getting shot, and you only have one slot of armor because having a better armor suit is another thing you need to find and then potentially lose and all this other stuff. And so I've done that a bunch, and I do it. It's easy. You can do it really fast, and you can do it before any other players have done it, because there are the other human players in this zone that are theoretically trying to do some of the same stuff, but I've yet to run into a situation where another person in another vehicle was trying to run that fucker over as I was trying to do it. But I'm sure that that's another potential situation. And so I can't, I have not even been able to get out and pick up the gun, because you're taking damage constantly, little by little, because you're in this radiation zone. And he's surrounded by guards that are like well armed. So it's just like, I'm just like dying in the radiation storm over and over again, trying to cheese this very desperately. And I don't think it's going to work. The actual way to really to cheaply get your hands on this gun is to go into the zone with someone that already has it, because once they have it unlocked, they can drop it, you can pick it up, and then you can just extract, and then it will unlock for you as well. And so that's been a thing people have been doing. They should probably fix that part of it up, I guess. I don't know, but it's a very weird mode. And so the other thing in the zone that is kind of, you know, because you'll find these keys and you'll go and you'll find all this loot, and the loot is weird because it's Call of Duty, right? You're like operators. You are some tier one beard having guys. You are going in there. You are badass. You are backed up by money. You are backed up by American dollar, whatever country you are backed up by dark money, PMC money, whatever it is. Something wealthy is at your back because you are a skilled military murder man or lady. But the zone is full of garbage. And it's like comic books and jumper cables and liquor bottles and lighters and a gold bar and all of this other stuff. As you're walking around in these buildings, opening up tool cases and duffel bags and all this other stuff, you are just finding vendor trash practically. And so I guess you can take those to a buy station in the world, which I guess it does have buy stations similar to Warzone, and you can loot fucking parts out of a computer. Like, you're like meth fiends going, like, you might as well be stripping the fucking copper out of the walls or cutting catalytic converters off. All they need to add that, if they need to add the ability to disable vehicles. Like, you're like, oh, if you see a vehicle, you can get in and drive, or you can cut the cat off it, and that cat's worth $2,000. Like, they need to let you fucking cut the catalytic converter off of cars in this game, because it is that fucking messed up, the type of crime you are committing in this thing, like looting all this stupid stuff. And so you can extract with it, and I guess if you extract with it, the money turns into XP, and then if you have one of your insured gun slots is on cooldown because you died and it's like 2 hours or whatever, the money will reduce that cooldown a certain amount. And so extracting with money will help you get your good gun back, I guess, if you want to go that way with it. But you can cash that stuff in at a buy station. I have yet to go that route with it because I'm just going in there and trying to run over this idiot over and over again. And so the DMZ mode is that mostly. And so you will make your way through multiple tiers of missions as you go. And so the one I'm on now, I think, is the last tier one mission. And it's like, get a stronghold key and then go into stronghold and fuck a bunch of people up. And you're like, okay, I can't do that. Because I'm mostly playing alone, and that's the wrong way to play. And again, that's on me. I do wish that there was maybe a way to play DMZ solos, like, a, you know, if they had that, that'd be nice. But anyway, yeah. So the kind of thing that I need to do to advance to unlock the next set of quests is to get into a stronghold and do stuff. Yes, Plastic Priest. That is the new name for the DMZ mode. It is Degenerate Meth Zone. Get in there all itchy, steal some jumper cables for $80, and then extract on a helicopter going like, I got my jumper cables. It's fucking ridiculous, but it's interesting. You know, it is an interesting twist on the mechanics of Warzone, of Call of Duty, and all that sort of stuff. And it's another way to kind of play against AI. There are other humans in the zone. And so there's there's another weapon case in the world every time you go in, and whenever anyone picks that weapon case up, it immediately notifies all the other human players in the world, like, here's where this fucker is. And so what they're going to try to do is take that case to one of the extraction points. When you get to the extraction point, it takes time because you're calling in a helicopter. It takes time for the helicopter to show up, lower itself. As it's happening, AI is kind of swarming the point. So you're kind of fighting them off as you're desperately trying to wait for this helicopter, get on this helicopter and get away. And also, if you have that weapon case, then every other human player knows that you're trying to leave with the weapon case. And so they're going to try and come after you. I don't know what's in the weapon case, if it's just like another, if it's just random blueprints or what the deal is. And so you've seen, there are some awesome, and again, this is, this is why I keep, this is why I keep watching Call of Duty videos on TikTok, is you see these fucking ridiculous moments, whether it's people using the proximity chat to set up all sorts of like weird shenanigans, or just like, because the helicopter takes a long time to not only come in, but a long time to get away. And also, anyone can get on that fucking helicopter. And so there's so many videos of like a full squad of three people just sitting on the helicopter, and you're like, oh man, that was close. Can't believe we made it. And then one guy jumps on the fucking side door and is behind them, and then just guns them all down on the helicopter and picks up their shit as the helicopter's flying away. I saw a video of one guy jumped on, because the helicopter blades don't hurt you, which is potentially, I'm tempted to say they should fix that, but also if it leads to this, then they should allow it. A guy got on top of the helicopter, and as it started taking off, he dropped down and was basically looking through the windshield of the helicopter, the front of the helicopter, and then through that, crouched, sitting on the front of the fucking outside of the helicopter, gunned down this entire fucking squad, and then fell off. He couldn't even get the shit, but it was so badass that it was just like, nope, fuck you, you don't get to extract with this shit, fuck off, because he couldn't get around to the door to get on, and so he gained nothing from it other than the pure satisfaction of hearing their voice chat of going, what the fuck? What? Oh, you pussy. Oh. And so proximity chat is why I turn chat back on in this game, because I want to hear people as they scream, as they die. and you know, and vice versa. If I, you know, get a word out to them as I go down, but I'm mostly playing Call of Duty at night, so I'm not really on a microphone at all ever. And so just watching these scenarios play out, and there's a lot of, you know, the proximity chat is also leading to some interesting situations, because you can get in certain modes. I think it works in DMZ, but I know it works in some of the Warzone modes as well. You have the ability to walk up to a player and go, hey, you want to join up with me? Let's join. Let's form a squad. Or like, hey, don't shoot me. Let's fucking be cool. I saw a video last night of basically two guys shaking down another player. Like a player was down but not dead. They had a self revive, and they're just talking to him, going like, yeah man, all right, fucking go ahead, use your self revive, and we want you to drop everything on your person, and then we'll let you go. We want all your money, everything, drop the guns. And it's just, they're both just sitting there, guns trained on this guy. And the guy just like fucking threw all his inventory out. Like, here's the guns, here's a UAV I had, all this other stuff. And then he jumps out a window. And as the guy is running away, they're just like, yeah, we'll catch you up with you later. It's just like crazy shit that, like, if you know, it's borderline on a role playing. But just some fascinating moments out there. Of like, you know, one guy going like, oh, I'll give you a ride over to the buy station. Oh, you're trying to buy back, you know, because if you have the right amount of money, you can buy back your teammate, I guess, in some, I don't know if that's in every mode in the new Warzone or whatever. You know, so you got guys going like, oh, just get in, I'll give you a ride over there. Oh, you don't have the money for it? Here, I'll give you the money. And then the guy goes through the process of using the money to buy back his teammate, and as soon as he's done at the buy station, the guy goes, all right, cool man, I said I'd let you buy back your teammate, but I didn't say I'd let you live, and then guns him down. And it's real silly shit, real silly shit that people are getting up to hijinks out there in the war zone. And that stuff looks like a lot of fun. That stuff looks like, I don't know how I would want it. The proximity chat is weird because it works. It doesn't work the way it maybe should. It works. I think if you're within 55 meters of another player, you can hear their mic audio, but it doesn't necessarily work in a way that it's like, it's super quiet if you're far away. And if you're up close, it's just kind of like, if you're within this range, you can hear it. And so it doesn't seem like it always places it in the world properly. I haven't heard it myself too much because there aren't that many players out there talking, and I'm certainly not talking. I let the guns do the talking. I won a Warzone match, and that felt real good. That felt real, real good. And yeah, DMZ is really interesting. It is, yeah, we'll kind of see what they do with it, right? I mean, it's the sort of thing that, like, that right now the zone is pretty set. Like, the various things, explaining why Sea of Thieves is fun, but it's, yes, but also the stuff you do in Sea of Thieves is not nearly as fun. I think that's the big problem there, is like, yes, the social engineering aspect of Sea of Thieves is the reason why that game exists, but for the longest time it was still just like, all right, we got to go here and club these skeletons and get this treasure and do this, and it was just like, and you're just getting fucked over at the end. And this happens on a much tighter timer. You can get fucked over every 5 minutes if you want to. And I think that helps a lot. It helps take the sting out of it, right? The idea of Sea of Thieves, and you're just like, all right, we went on this really long voyage and made all this shit happen, and oh, there was someone near the port and they fucking sunk our ship and stole our shit. Fuck this. This is much more like the Dark Zone stuff in The Division, where it's a lot more it's a lot easier to kind of jump in and jump out and have the shorter version of that experience. And I think that's very key. Very, very key. Because I think if you're losing too much, and also, I mean, Sea of Thieves didn't have the rewards also in a general sense. I mean, it had cosmetics and stuff of that nature, but it was just like, nothing I ever got for playing Sea of Thieves made me think, oh boy, I want to keep playing Sea of Thieves. It was more like, I did all that and this is what is on the other side of this. What the fuck am I doing? You know what I mean? What would I add to DMZ is the question. So that's the big question, right? I mean, right now when you launch into that zone, it is the different points move around, like where the chemist is, where the weapon case is, that stuff's in different places. But I think the layout is largely the same. Like if you get the key for like its disused warehouse on grid marker B4, like that building is always there. Like it's the same basic spot of the war zone map. So at some point they'll just pick up that circle and plop it down somewhere else in the war zone map. And you know, that will be a significant change because like you'll have to get new keys and all that other stuff. But also, I think, you know, if they put in, there probably needs to be more. And I haven't really seen the rest of the missions because there's like faction missions and all this other stuff. It's not really clear again, because I haven't really spent a lot of time playing with other players, and you need to do that to pull off some of these things. And so I'm still stuck on kind of a low tier mission or whatever. And yeah, I think it's fascinating. It's a fascinating application of the Call of Duty mechanics. And I don't know what they'll need to do to keep it fresh. Because right now a big draw is like, hey, this is straight up a gun you don't have and you can't currently get it any other way. Eventually they'll sell different blueprints for that gun in their store. And all that other stuff, and there'll be multiple ways to get access to that specific type of assault rifle or whatever. But right now, the only way to get it is to pull it off that dude's dead body and escape with it. And I think that's neat, because it's not something you have to have. The game's got plenty of weapons you get other ways, so you don't necessarily. It doesn't seem like something that's like super overpowered in the other modes. That if you're like, oh, well, I extracted this gun and now I'm fucking 30-0 on every multiplayer map I play on or whatever. But it's interesting. It's an interesting way to kind of deliver access to that gun. And they've done some of that. I think there's the potential to get blueprints in the Warzone mode as well. Warzone is more Warzone. I don't know. Like there are meaningful differences to it in terms of how the inventory works, and there's a ton of nuance there that if you were a Warzone player, you'd be like, oh, this is dramatically different. But I think the high level version of it that, you know, if you are playing it, then you already know all this. But, you know, for the rest of you, the high level version of it is like, yeah, they've made some significant changes, but it's, you know, it's still that game. You know, it is still that battle royale experience and all of that sort of stuff. They've shaken up the way you get access to your loadouts. They've found ways to put AI soldiers onto the map in ways that don't feel dumb. And stuff like that. So yeah, I don't know. A lot of it feels very well thought out. They're branding the DMZ as a beta right now, and so you get the impression that they're like, this is a thing we are into, but not necessarily super confident about. So, you know, like, it's the sort of thing that probably, as time goes on, I think that they will get access to more data as more and more people play it, and they'll figure some stuff out. I would love to see that thing balanced a little bit better for solo play, as someone who prefers to play alone. That's, you know, purely selfishly, I guess. But also, it's one of those modes that you see the value in rolling in there with the crew and getting shit done and getting out and all that sort of stuff. Like, it has neat ideas. All right, why don't we take another break here, and we'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about Evil West, and you know, and we'll get into the news and all of that sort of stuff. Stay tuned. We'll be back real soon.
The nights are getting longer, but the breeze isn't the only thing that's getting stiff.
That's right. This episode is brought to you in part by Blue Chew. What can Blue Chew Blue do for Blue You? Well, let's talk about it. It can help in the bedroom. You know, when it comes time to step up to the plate, to get it done, to make things happen in the pants zone, you're looking to have a little pants fun. Well, if your pants fun is not going down the way you want it to, perhaps Blue Chew is for you. Blue Chew is a unique online service that delivers the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in chewable tablets and at a fraction of the cost. You can take them anytime, day or night, so you can plan ahead or just be ready whenever an opportunity arises. The process is very simple. Sign up at BlueChew.com, consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. And it's all done online. No visits to the doctor's office, no awkward conversations, no waiting in line at the pharmacy, just rock hard erections for you as whenever you need them, day or night. These chewable tablets are there at your disposal when it's time to fucking fuck. If you need this for the fucking, you will have it on you. You will keep that thing on you with Blue Chew, you know? Always be ready to go. Blue Chew's tablets are made in the USA and prepared and shipped direct to your door in a discreet package. Discreet American hard-ons. Ready for you. Throbbing. Standing tall. For old glory. And for fucking. For doing the fuck with it. You know, look, we can sit here, we can talk about stepping up to the plate and all this other. Yeah, no, yes, of course. Confidence can take you far in life, definitely. And confidence absolutely can help in the bedroom. And what form does that confidence take? That's right. Your rock hard penis ready to go. Ready to make it happen. Ready for fun? Dare I say it? Might I make such a bold claim as to say that perhaps intercourse might be fun? I, you know, hey, look, it takes all kinds. Far be it for me to ensure that this is fun. You know, but it's a good time. Can I say that? It can be a great time. Blue Chew, it's ready for you when you need it. And you get it all online. You don't have to dick around with going to the doctor and all this other stuff. And it's not happening in the area with my. You can do it all online and just get it shipped directly to your door. So if you could benefit from extra confidence when it's time to perform, Blue Chew can help. And here's a special deal for you. Try Blue Chew for free when you use the promo code Jeff at checkout. Just pay $5 shipping. That's bluechew.com, promo code Jeff, to receive your first month for free. Visit bluechew.com for more details and important safety information. And we thank Blue Chew for sponsoring the podcast. All right, we're back. Evil West is, it just came out on Steam last night, and I just started getting into it. I've not had a ton of time with it, and so I'm not sure how I feel about it. People seem like they are a little split, a little all over the place with it. You are some kind of weird cyber cowboy with some kind of steampunk crazy metal arm, and eventually you do get access to guns and stuff like that, but you are fighting eldritch, I don't know, weird walking elephant trunks and insane monsters. And through the whole tutorial, you know, I'm still very early in the game. A lot of the tutorial is very much about you punching the crap out of stuff, and that largely feels pretty good. It's all in the right bumper. A lot of your melee attacks and stuff like that. So it's like if you hold down the melee attack, it will do a uppercut launcher, and then you can mash the button to keep that juggle going. But if you keep holding that button down, your cowboy man will actually do a launcher and then immediately follow it up with a Superman punch that will basically punch guys off of edges or into spikes in a bullet storm-esque fashion. Evil West is interesting, you know, because you would do eventually get access to a pistol, and the pistol feels weak in comparison. I mean, I don't know if that's, again, not having played the rest of the game, I don't know if that's indicative of it is largely a melee combat game and the guns are just kind of there for show or whatever, or for very specific situations when you're at range. But the pistol you get as part of the kind of introductory part of that game feels very weak. And so the big metal arm punch feels very strong as you are just pounding the crap out of these creepy looking Lovecraftian, I guess, monsters and different things. It's a, you know, it's also a game where it's like, oh, hey, there's a larger enemy and their attacks are, you know, going to be a little harder to block or harder to deal with or whatever. But they give you a Duke Nukem-esque foot as well when you click in the right stick, that at least with the first set of enemies that have really big axes and stuff like that, like it interrupts them out of every single attack. And so you can just punch them twice and you see them wind up and you're like, oh, check this out. Stick your foot out, kick them, knock them out of that animation, punch them a few more times. You see them start to wind up again, hit them again, keep going, all that sort of stuff. And it actually, that I think that stuff actually feels pretty good too, weirdly enough. You've got a, you know, the ability to kind of duck out of the way or dodge roll or stuff like that. But, other than when those big enemies get their attacks off, you definitely need to dodge them and all that sort of stuff. It's a nice looking game. The opening of the game is a big, huge train crash, and then it's full of lore and all this other stuff and Evil West, and it's evil, it's West, and all that sort of stuff. I don't know, like the setting and all that stuff has not immediately kind of grabbed me or anything like that, but it's, from a gameplay perspective, it seems at least interesting, and I want to keep going with it to kind of see how it develops. It needs, you know, obviously, like I'm still in the first hour or so. So, you know, hopefully the gameplay continues to expand in really meaningful ways and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it seems like the reaction to it has been a little mixed. And so it kind of makes me wonder, it feels like the kind of weird third person game that kind of doesn't, a lot of these, it just feels like these don't get made anymore. It's very linear. It's very like you killed all the enemies and now this chain over here is glowing and, oh, you, now you can hop over this wall and keep going and all that sort of stuff. And, yeah, it's definitely got B game vibes coming off of it for real. And that's kind of nice. So I don't know. go check out a little bit of footage of Evil West and see what you think. I will probably create some footage of that game sometime this week. We'll do some streaming, all that sort of stuff. Perhaps that will be one of the games that I take a look at. We will see. And I don't know. There's definitely some promise there for sure, but we'll see how the rest of it pans out. That's kind of my vibe on it, is like, this seems like something that's going to start out fun and then maybe not develop enough to feel fun all the way through. And about 2/3 of the way through, you're going to go, this is the same shit over and over again. But I am just guessing, but that is definitely the vibe I'm getting from it. So we'll kind of see how it goes. But again, like I said, I was just able to start playing it last night when it finally came out. So I have not gotten deep into the game. So hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully it's, you know, hopefully it develops in some really crazy ways, but we will see. Why don't we get into a little bit of the news? How about that? Yuji Naka got a pop. That dude got popped. They hooked him up. They went and said, Mr. Naka, will you come with us, please? Yuji Naka, largely known as the creator of Sonic the Hedgehog, finally arrested for his crimes against humanity. And we got him. It took a good long time, ladies and gentlemen. We got him. This is an insider trading arrest. This is an insider trading story, according to Kotaku. And the report is that this is around a studio called Aiming, which was announced as the developer of a new Dragon Quest game called Tact back in 2020. And I guess this is something that a couple of Square Enix employees who would know, hey, we're about to announce that we're doing this deal with this company Aiming for this Tact game. I guess a couple of people said, like, well, why don't we go buy a bunch of shares in Aiming right before we make this announcement? Because that seems like a really good way for us to maybe make a little bit of money. It was originally alleged that a 38-year-old Square Enix employee named Taisuke Sasaki was arrested. And Sasaki has worked on Final Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts, so a double criminal. And then Yuji Naka was, I guess, picked up as well. Of course, you know, Naka was working at Square as part of Balan Wonderworld and all this other stuff. So potentially this is something that, you know, he would have known about and all this other stuff. There's a, yeah, so he was arrested. He was alleged to have purchased 10,000 shares, which is around $20,000. Whereas Sasaki apparently purchased about almost a little under $200,000 worth of shares. There was a third person also taken into custody, arrested over this, that Kotaku does not seem to have the name of. Now we're getting in. So I'm getting word from the Discord here, a link to a tweet from John Harrison, who's working on a book called Legends of 16-Bit Game Development, and he's linking to a Japanese YouTube video. But I guess basically the gist of what he is saying here is that Yoshiki Okamoto, who was the producer of Street Fighter II, thinks that there's something fishy with Yuji Naka's arrest. This is a tweet on Twitter.com. He suspects Naka was set up due to his lawsuit with Square Enix, since many things about the case don't make sense. And then it is a link to a Japanese language YouTube video that I am not going to dive into at this time. But boy, wouldn't it be fun if there was weird fallout from, I mean, fun, not fun for Yuji Naka, but fun if someone set him up over this stuff because they didn't like him that much back in 2020 when Balan Wonderworld was, when did Balan Wonderworld ship? Because this would have been, that shipped in 2020, right? 2021. Okay, so he would have been there through 2020 doing his thing and all this other stuff. So maybe someone set him up and gave him information. Who knows? I don't know. We'll see how this shakes out. This seems like it gives it another wrinkle that is a potential for mess, whereas otherwise it just seemed like a straightforward kind of insider trading sort of situation. And the amount of money that Naka put in, I mean, 20K, it's not, you know, not like that's life-changing money for him or anything like that. So I don't know. You know, this to me struck me as one of those things where, I think I said it last week when we were streaming, you know how when the Oscars come around and they give someone an Oscar for like the wrong movie at the end of their career because that person got fucked over on a Best Picture Oscar 30 years ago or 40 years ago or something, like, your classic movie that has become one of the greatest movies of all time, for whatever reason, it didn't win an Oscar that year. And boy, we really screwed up. And now you got this shitty passion project out and no one really likes it, but they like you. And they know that you're getting up there in years and you didn't ever win an Oscar. So you're going to get the Oscar this year for this fucking thing. And it'll all work out and be fine. And, you know, is this Yuji Naka finally paying for decades of crimes, you know, from Balan Wonderworld all the way back to Nights into Dreams, Sonic the Hedgehog? You know, run down the list of reasons we should be locking up Yuji Naka. I am fucking around. Because also that man's name is attached to Phantasy Star. And so basically, as much as I don't think people should be above the law, what about someone? What about Fantasy? What about that? What about the people involved with Phantasy Star? How about that? So yeah, we'll see if that develops. The Okamoto statement is an interesting wrinkle in all of this stuff. I don't know what that means long term for or what happens next in this sort of stuff, or what we will even hear about it next, because it just seems like one of those situations that's just going to disappear and we'll hear about some outcome later, you know, in a year or two, like, oh, that lawsuit happened and yeah, I guess all this happened. So why don't we take our last commercial break and then we'll come back and we'll do the rest of the news and the rest of the program as well. I will admit it. I will say it. I am not a composting expert. When I think about composting, the first thing that always came to mind was the trash heap out back, Fraggle Rock style. It was just a massive pile of food stink that any kid I went to school with that had hippie parents, they were like, "Yeah, man, we got the heap out back, bro." And it always seemed like a nightmare. So I've never really been a part of the composting revolution. But now, there's a better way. Because now, there's Lomi from Pila. Lomi allows you to turn your food scraps into dirt with the push of a button. It's a countertop electric composter that can turn your scraps into dirt in under 4 hours. It doesn't stink, and when it runs, it's really quiet. You know, if you got toddlers in the house, if you got babies in the house, then you might know a thing or two about fussy eaters that don't want to eat anything and leave a mountain of macaroni and cheese behind at every turn. Ugh. And what do you do with that macaroni and cheese? Are you going to eat it? Sometimes, but not all the time. Sometimes you're like, this beefaroni, I just can't anymore with this. I just can't. I cannot. And so a lot of stuff just gets tossed out. But now, that stuff can get tossed into the Lomi. That's good for the environment because it means it's not going to go rot in some landfill and produce a bunch of methane or anything like that. Instead, you are producing nutrient-rich dirt that you can feed to your plants. Now that's a nice turnaround, huh? All you do, again, you just fill it up, push the button, it goes and does its thing. And it's just a quiet countertop device. You can set it up in the kitchen. You can put it out in the garage if you want. Whatever. The end result is the same. Way less garbage every week because all that food garbage is now being turned into, again, nutrient-rich dirt. And then what are you going to do with that dirt? I don't know. You can throw the dirt away, I guess, if you want to. But, you know, hey, you could also go sprinkle it on your plants. You got grass that maybe could benefit from some additional nutrients. You know, these days, if you're out west, it's just an endless drought of everything, so this grass needs all the help it can get. So why not put a little bit of that nutrient rich dirt on there, you know, and use that soil instead of just throwing away all of this food. This kid doesn't eat. This kid wants three different things. It's like, first it's macaroni and cheese, takes two bites of that. It's like, no, I want these butter wheels instead. Then make the butter wheels. It's like half the butter wheels, and then you got that setting aside, and then in the end it's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and that gets half eaten, and you're like, what am I getting? You could pull out your hair, or you could pull out your Lomi. And if you want to start making a positive environmental impact, or just make cleanup after dinner that much easier, Lomi is perfect for you. Head to Lomi.com/Jeff and use the promo code Jeff to get $50 off your Lomi. That's $50 off when you head to lomi.com/Jeff and use the promo code Jeff at checkout. Food waste is gross, especially when you're putting it in the garbage with other not gross stuff. Lomi is the solution. With the holidays just around the corner, Lomi will make the perfect gift for someone on your shopping list. And we thank Lomi for sponsoring the podcast. All right, we're back. We are back with the rest of the news. Microsoft says it offered Sony a 10-year deal to keep Call of Duty on PlayStation. This is Eurogamer's version of this story around the Microsoft acquisition of Activision Blizzard King. And this just still seems like absolute nonsense. The details here are coming out of the New York Times, and then Microsoft basically told the New York Times that it offered Sony a 10-year deal to keep the series on PlayStation earlier this month. And basically, Sony has called Microsoft's offers inadequate on many levels, is the exact quote. And Jim Ryan supposedly flew to Brussels to meet the EU regulators and to appeal Microsoft's deal in person, and has given statements like, by giving Microsoft control of Activision games like Call of Duty, this deal would have major negative implications for gamers and the future of the gaming industry. And then in that New York Times piece, Microsoft accused Sony of misleading regulators, saying the company had overstated the importance of Call of Duty to its viability. In response, Jim Ryan told the publication this was not true, adding Microsoft was a tech giant with a long history of dominating industries, and that it is highly likely that the choices gamers have today will disappear if this deal goes ahead. This seems dumb. This continues to seem dumb. I don't know. This seems like smart on Sony's part, I guess, on some level. Like, if they can gum up the works on this long enough to get as many different weird concessions out of Microsoft as they can, and probably what I wonder if they would settle for, if Microsoft came out and said, okay, we won't offer Call of Duty on Game Pass for 10 years. We will force people to buy it for $60, $70. Maybe then Sony would be like, okay, cool. Uh-huh. But this just seems like Sony trying to figure out what they can get away with to fuck this up for as long as they can. Because I tend to agree with the Microsoft position on this, that Sony is overstating the importance of Call of Duty to its viability. know, there are a lot of different things you can look at, like Nintendo, who does not have a Call of Duty. Over to just like, yes, there are a million other shooters on the market. And honestly, like, if there was a scenario where Call of Duty was no longer on PlayStation, it would open the door for other similar games to come through and thrive. Like, would there be people who are big enough Call of Duty fans that like, well, I guess I got to go get an Xbox? Yeah. But not so many that it's going to like completely dismantle the PlayStation business. Because the PlayStation business, when you look at the worldwide numbers, even here in the US, Microsoft is not a fucking threat to them. Like, are they a competitor? Are they a competitor that forces Sony to make some adjustments to the way that, are they often a thorn in Sony's side? Sure. Yes. But yeah, I don't know. And I'm speaking as like someone who thinks like, you know, that this year's Call of Duty is a good, strong sign that that series is not on the ropes quite as much as you want to think after the past couple of years of putting out subpar games. Like, it really does just take them to put out one good one and they earn back a lot of goodwill along the way. You know, like, that series is singular in a lot of ways. There's nothing else quite like Call of Duty out there in terms of its impact and all this sort of stuff. But again, you were opening up a situation where if EA could ever get their shit together and ship a good multiplayer, you know, if Titanfall 3 could ever happen, for example, or if there was it was actually a good Battlefield game for once. It's been a little bit since there was a truly great Battlefield game, but there are plenty of other shooters out there that would love for, and honestly, that's not even what Microsoft is putting on the table. But if it went that supremely fucking in the other direction, there are plenty of developers who would line up to be like, oh my God, we would love to make a PlayStation exclusive shooter for you. Or like, hey, you just bought Bungie. You know, you got some chops there that know how to make a shooter or two or three or five. Fuck it. You can make another Killzone for a change, huh? Why don't we bring back some Killzone while we're at it? Is Killzone Call of Duty? Absolutely not. Could it be a good, solid fucking first-person shooter on a platform, especially a platform that didn't have Call of Duty on it? Absolutely. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It's the sort of thing that, like, it really just feels like Sony is just doing everything it can to make this deal suck or make this a hassle in a way that will get them as much as they can out of it, because Microsoft is going to get to a point where they're just like, fine, we have to close this deal. Like, we can't just let this fucking twist in the wind. Like, we're on the hook for this. Like, we have to just fucking whatever concessions, like, they're eventually going to force Microsoft to give up something else or something is my guess on how this will go. And there was quotes from like some of the regulators. They're saying like, they're going to keep games off our PlayStation, which, you know, seemed like a somewhat biased position to take. They had to walk that statement back and be like, oh, the person who said this is not part of the decision-making process, blah, 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 blah. All this other stuff. It's just weirdly, it is just a weird deal all around. I don't know. And this doesn't seem like I disagree with the position that choices gamers have today will disappear if this deal goes ahead. Again, if you look at the install base of the PlayStation compared to the install base of the Xbox platforms alone, it'd be fucking dumb to take that game off PlayStation. Like, even in a world where they offer it on Game Pass on Xbox platforms, they would love to sell it to you for full price on these other platforms as well. You know, they would love to put that game on Steam. Microsoft puts all its games on Steam, and they're like, yeah, you could get it on Game Pass, but I guess if you just are one of those weirdos that will only accept buying games on Steam, sure, we'll allow you to give us $60 for this. Fine. Go ahead. And that feels like the way that Microsoft, we've talked about this. I don't want to like just sit here and fucking go over it over all over again, but it, you know, this is how Microsoft has largely handled Minecraft. You know? And these franchises that have already been on all these platforms. And so I don't see a world where Microsoft, unless, you know, hey, also 10 years is a long time. We'll be on new hardware by then. What will hardware even be by then? Blah, blah, blah. But that's why I think the statement out of Phil Spencer is saying, you know, we'll continue releasing Call of Duty games on Sony's consoles for as long as there's a PlayStation out there to ship to, you know? And then on November 11th, they proposed a 10-year deal to keep Call of Duty on PlayStation. So I don't know. This to me sounds like that Sony is just trying to hold out for as long as they can or some additional concession. I bet around Game Pass. I bet if Microsoft said, okay, we'll keep it off of Game Pass for 5 years and not put it on part of our subscription service, that Sony would probably be like, okay. What about 10 years? What if we did that for 10 years? All that sort of stuff. I don't know. Just seems like a weird, I'm not like fucking Mr. Corporate fucking merger over here either, but at the same time, Activision fucking sucks. Like the elite Activision leadership is a fucking disaster too. Like it just, yeah, I don't know. It's a mess all around. An absolute mess all around. Hey, you want an ad-free version of this show? A show that has no ads? You can do it. You can head over to patreon.com/Jeff Gerstmann. You'll get an audio version of this podcast that is absolutely ad-free. No ad breaks. Sometimes I insert silly music into where the ad breaks go, which is a fun surprise for everyone. So head over to what there's a variety of ways you can get there. dopeassvideogames.com, enjoyyourgaming.com goes there. Is that
enjoy your game?
Yeah, we've got that. We got a dedicated button, dang it. So head over there and find out more. You can also get access to the Discord, which is a lot of fun, and at additional levels you can also get access to Game Boys to Men, the latest episode of which was recorded yesterday. I've got to just put some light edits onto that and get that out. This is a special episode about Mortal Kombat. And we're joined by Glenn Rubenstein, and I are joined by one Ryan McDonald, who was with us on all those early Vegas trips, the third man in our Bomberman tournament. And all of that sort of stuff. This was the first time I had even seen Ryan. I mean, not that I saw him in person, but like I ran into Ryan in the hallway at E3 outside of our meeting room area. He was there just visiting to say hi to everybody because he was there wiring up a booth for Verizon or somebody. I forget. He was doing some kind of work for some other booth. Saw him there, and then he skittered away to go get work done. So it was good to catch up with him. A ton of stuff that just hasn't, and that dude's got, there's, if you want video footage of me at age, let's say, I'm gonna say probably 19 based on the way the room looks, you want footage of me at age 19 looking into a camera and proclaiming some foul language into that camera, then might I recommend the next episode of Game Boys to Men, as it is, so that should be up a little later this week. So give that a listen for sure. Very excited about that one. It was a lot of fun to do, and I have not talked to this group of people, me, Glenn, and Ryan. I cannot remember the last time the three of us were together. We were the first three hires when GameSpot got into wanting to cover console games. Glenn was number one, Ryan was number two, when I was number three, kind of all through the door within the first couple of months there. And I can't remember the last time all three of us were together. Super weird, but super fun. Anyway, that'll be up there soon, so give that a look. Getting back to the news, Team Ninja is planning reboots for Ninja Gaiden and Dead or Alive. This was confirmed by Fumihiko Yasuda, who's the head of Team Ninja at G-Star in South Korea. And sure. Yeah, I don't know what rebooting Dead or Alive means at this point, other than I guess just don't call it DOA 7. What do you need to reboot there? Like, are you going to reboot the fiction? Are you like, no, Fame Douglas doesn't have an island or a boat. What are we? No. This is a totally different. I don't know what you're even doing at that point. But I guess so. So this statement has been softened a little bit. Team Ninja gave a statement to Video Games Chronicle and said it had no specific details or information to share on his future plans for the series. This is basically what Yasuda said at G-Star. But the quote is as follows. Dead or Alive and Ninja Gaiden are both long-standing pillar franchises for Team Ninja. These celebrated titles are synonymous with our studio history and reputation, creative director Tom Lee told Video Games Chronicle. It goes without saying that when speaking about the development of our past and future projects, both of these important titles cannot be left without mention. However, there are no details or information to share on either of these franchises at this present time. Like many of our dedicated fans, we share the enthusiasm for the return of these beloved titles, and we will be sure to provide a proper update if and when that day arrives. So kind of softening the statement, but also Yasuda didn't exactly come out and say, absolutely, this is happening and it's in development or anything like that. It was more just like, yeah, this is something we're looking to do. And there's zero details beyond that. was really kind of the crux of the statement there. I kind of file this under like, yeah, of course you are. Like, yeah, guess what? Team Ninja is going to do a new Ninja Gaiden and there's going to be another Dead or Alive. Like, no shit. Huh? Who could have guessed that they weren't just going to make Neo sequels for the end of time? Yeah, no, it's those franchises, I think, are huge. And again, they are synonymous with the franchise, with Team Ninja. And also, Dead or Alive is good. The Dead or Alive fighting game series is good. It's fun. It's silly. Like, I know it gets caught up in all the fucking, like, $5,000 of bikini DLC. But under those skimpy bikinis is a lot of fun. It's a fun, silly fighting game series. I know people try to take it very seriously and there is high level play. I'm not one of those people. I think it is just a good Virtua Fighter like fighting game with interesting block and counter mechanics and very flashy graphics and crazy backgrounds and all this other kind of fun stuff. And the ladies kick high. No, you know, whatever. The Dead or Alive games have largely been fun. Like the fighting games, the beach volleyball and all the other horse shit, like whatever, especially these days. Like imagine that, like, why do any of these like skimpy bikini beach volleyball games? Like, they're not good games. Generally speaking, you're not getting like a good, like, oh, the butt bump mini game is really a lot of fun in this. And you're not getting real porn. Let's just stop. Steam is rotten with games that are full of hardcore fucking. You know, that stuff is just out there. And yet, like, the last one of these, like DOA Extreme 3, it's shipped on Steam, but you cannot purchase it if you are in the United States, because they I remember they issued a statement at the time. They were like, well, the United States attitudes towards this type of content, we're just not going to release it and all this other stuff. At the time, it was just like, all right, I guess, like, sure. It's fucking corny shit either way. But we live in a world where, like, actual porno games are hitting Steam's top charts and all this other stuff. And so what are you going to do with your bikini volleyball game? You know? Unless you're going to go all the way. You give us Dead or Alive Extreme 4, : this time we're going all the way. And then when you fire it up, instead of an Aerosmith song, it plays that Insane Clown Posse song about let's go all the way. It just plays that. And hey, let's go all the way. If you want to keep making this stuff. Because it's Steam, again, Steam is rotten with various weird sex games. I saw one that seemed to be an arena shooter. that also had sex in it. And I was like, I bet that's bad at both of those things. And maybe I'll try it out someday. I don't know. But because most of them are just like, here's a visual novel and we made some art. No, I'm not making air quotes to say it's not art. I'm making air quotes to say by art we mean naked sex ladies, and so on and so forth. Anyway, they should make another Dead or Alive. And they should make another Ninja Gaiden. These feel like no-brainer type of moves. I would love to see another DOA. I occasionally, like when the Steam Deck came out, I installed the most recent DOA on it and played it on the Steam Deck for a while. And I was like, this game is just good, clean fun. You mash those buttons and fucking punches come out and it's highs and lows and all this other stuff. And, you know, like I love Virtua Fighter. I love, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And this game is not, I don't think this game is as good as Virtua Fighter is, but I'm still having an okay time with it and so on and so forth and all that. So I, you know, whatever. They should make those. Volition is now a part of Gearbox. This is, it seems like the Embracer Group is finally doing the thing that it seemed weird that they weren't doing, which is they're taking a look at everything they own and going like, oh, man, a lot of people work here, huh? Ooh. Boy. What do we want to do about that? And so, yes, as part of their kind of larger kind of financial details, they said that they would be reorging some of this stuff, and now the Volition Studio is technically a part of the Gearbox Group. This doesn't actually mean much of anything, and you see people throwing Randy Pitchford's name around a lot about this stuff because, you know. But honestly, at this point, Randy Pitchford has kind of ascended. Randy is the head of the, what is it? It's the Gearbox Entertainment Group, which is the kind of larger entity that they created to exist above the Gearbox Studio. So now Gearbox, the studio in Texas and wherever else they have locations, is now, I think, run by its own leadership and all this other stuff, but it still kind of reports into this Gearbox Entertainment Group. But meanwhile, that Gearbox Entertainment Group, and specifically, I believe, as I've been led to believe, the head of that entertainment group is busy thinking about the movies that they're making, you know, because obviously Borderlands, I think, was originally supposed to come out this year. I think they're doing reshoots. I don't know if those reshoots have happened yet or what, but my understanding is that they were going to go do reshoots for that. And also the Duke Nukem film that they are going to do. So I suspect Randy Pitchford will be largely focused on that sort of stuff for a pretty long time and not necessarily as deep in the minutiae of like, here's what the next Saints Row is going to be, you know, or whatever. Part of the financial update that Embracer issued did say the reception of Saints Row did not meet the full expectations and left the fan base partially polarized, even if, and this is a Eurogamer's take on it, even if financially Saints Row has performed in line with management expectations. It's interesting to see them acknowledging that, because I feel like normally a lot of these financial things are really just looking at the numbers. There's like, yep, financially it performed in line with management expectations, but they are also acknowledging like, yeah, perhaps the IP was damaged along the way because now we have a fan base that has been polarized one way or the other about this game. And yeah, I mean, the truth to me is somewhere in the middle. I think that's a highly middling game with a lot of issues, and they'll fix the bugs and all that stuff. I don't know if they put that patch out yet or if it's coming soon, but they have said like, oh, we got a bunch of quality of life and bug fixes, hundreds of bug fixes coming to your way very soon and all this sort of stuff. But it's too late. You know, that game will go on sale and new people will buy it and they'll get a better experience. But I think for the people who were big enough Saints Row fans, they bought that game already and they played it and either they finished it or they didn't, and they have made up their mind like, yeah, you could go ahead and make it work better. I had a lot of weird bugs with that game for sure. But at the end of the day, it is still this very wishy-washy middle of the road thing that really should have committed harder to its characters and storyline and tone and all that sort of stuff. And instead that just stuff just kind of comes up in fits and starts in ways that are, feel kind of meaningless. It's just, it's not a good game. Like, yeah, you can, you'll patch it and it'll be a somewhat better middling game. Singular in the Twitch chat says, I already forgot there was a Saints Row reboot. Yeah, exactly. That's, I honestly had kind of forgot. I finished that game and I had forgotten that it happened until reading this news story. Also, Gearbox has acquired the Risk of Rain IP. If you remember, I believe they published Risk of Rain 2, physical versions of Risk of Rain 2. I think we're a part of the Gearbox publishing. This is a weird one. So they put out a Twitter image and said, after years of passionate publishing work on Risk of Rain 2, we have developed a deep love and respect for the IP. We are eager to prove ourselves as worthy custodians by continuing to bring you world-class content and ensuring a bright future for this genre-leading franchise. As for right now, we're working hard to bring Risk of Rain 2's Survivors of the Void DLC to consoles. We also can't wait to share more details soon about a very special passion project that we're working together on with our great friends at Hapu. It's a true love letter to the community. Hapu Games is the studio that, you know, that developed Risk of Rain, the franchise, and all this other stuff. And so you go like, oh, they're working together with the original developers. Okay. And then like the immediate follow-up on that is a Discord screen cap. I went and looked at it as the community manager for the franchise, assuming that this image is authentic. It is this person, the community manager for the franchise, saying, we will not be working on Risk of Rain 2 or any future titles. No. So for Gearbox to put out an image saying, yeah, we're working together. And for then the other studio being like, no, we are done with Risk of Rain. Hopefully that's a situation where the original IP holders got paid and sold it willingly and all that sort of stuff. And they're going to take that money and go off and make something new and better. Right? That's, you know, it takes two to tango. Hopefully it's not some kind of weird contract default, like, oh, you missed a deadline and now we own the IP. but I don't know what the actual situation is there. But yes, the Hapu people seem to be indicating that they are done with the Risk of Rain IP. So now I guess that's Gearboxes. That's a little weird. I don't know. Embracer seems to be feeling a bit of a crunch, you know, from just the kind of state of the world and all that sort of stuff. You know, Embracer's been riding high, acquiring studios left and right like crazy for a good long time. And part of this financial update was them saying, like, we're going to conduct a special review of all businesses so we can do the, you know, make great games and the quote here is maximize long-term shareholder value creation. Yeah, baby. Hell yeah, we got to maximize that motherfucking long-term shareholder value creation. That's why we're here. Headbutt a locker and go, yeah, fuck yeah. So, you know, they're open to spinning business units out into their own companies again, if that makes the most sense and all this other stuff. So it sounds like they're just looking at like, okay, we bought a lot of chess pieces and we bought them without ever once like really right-sizing those studios or do, you know, like, hey, we know central services or whatever. And that's great because it means people got to keep their jobs and all this other stuff. But honestly, there's probably a lot of duplicated efforts happening across all those different Embracer studios that you could reduce a lot of headcount in, say, human relations or, you know, like those sorts of central services, a publishing group, a PR. They bought a PR company. They have their own PR company as part of Embracer. So, you know, do they need to keep working with external PR firms when they've got their own firm in house? Like, maybe not. It's just a lot of stuff. So this special review, I assume, is them going like, where can we actually start to realize some of the benefits of all of the shit that we bought and find ways to, you know, make this stuff operate more in line with our goal of maximizing long-term shareholder value creation. I assume that means that they will eventually lay some people off as part of some larger reorg or something like that, but we will see. Again, they're also open to spinning units out into their own independent entities again, if that's the way, best way for it to go. So it sounds like they are not saying one way or the other, but I suspect it's the former more than it is the latter. And yeah, we'll see how it goes. Either way, I expect for them to maximize long-term shareholder value creation. So very excited. Ubisoft is returning to Steam. Remember when Ubisoft pulled other games off Steam and then EA pulled other games off Steam, and there was a little while there that, like, you know, Rockstar still like had its own launcher. The Bethesda launcher was just like, what? What are we doing? This is not a blanket policy sending every Ubisoft game back to Steam all at once, but it appears that Assassin's Creed Valhalla, Anno 1800, and Roller Champions will be the first up in terms of Ubisoft games returning to Steam. It's according to videogameschronicle.com. And there's no real indication if everything is coming or if this is going to continue to just be a case-by-case thing. And I would expect that Ubisoft probably leaves its launcher and store there. They would probably much rather you buy games from them because they keep all the money as opposed to giving Steam a cut. But at some point, they must have realized, like, oh, right. Everyone else, like, EA came back to Steam a long time ago. Call of Duty's back on Steam now. And now, hey, Ubisoft is like, yeah, I guess that makes the most sense. There's probably more money to be made by being on a store than not being on a store. So let's just go ahead and be on the store. So I assume this will eventually lead to all of their stuff coming back. But I also wouldn't be shocked to see them keep the Ubisoft client around, whether that's for whatever their subscription service is, or, you know, well, EA integrated the game, their EA Play stuff into Steam. So maybe we'll see that down the line for Ubi as well. I don't know. This is a very silly story. Also out of Video Games Chronicle, Sony and Honda could include PlayStation 5 consoles in electric cars is the headline. The companies are collaborating on an entertainment-focused Tesla rival. This is a Financial Times story featuring a statement from the heads of Sony Honda Mobility, which is, I guess, a joint venture they put together to try to figure out how to make cars. This is Sony going like, we could provide some technology for your Honda electric cars and do something really fancy. And this is more of a could than they are going to. The quote here that VGC has is, Sony has content, services, and entertainment technologies that move people. We are adapting these assets to mobility, and this is our strength against Tesla, said President Izumi Kawanishi. Tesla is not providing any content services, he said, adding that it was technologically possible to integrate the PlayStation 5 platform into their cars. And that's it. It's, you know, it's not... It's like, yeah, Sony has a lot of stuff. We could put a PS5 in a car. Fuck it. I don't know. We could put the Men in Black franchise. Is that a Sony Pictures joint? I don't know. You put, when you start the car, Will Smith comes on the screen and he says, you're driving a car. And then he puts his glasses on and says, Men in Black in theaters now. I don't know. To enjoy the space in your car, you have to make it a space where you don't need to drive. Says Kawanishi, the solution for this is autonomous driving. No, the solution for this is a fucking bus, man. Or better trains. And then put out some kind of handheld Sony device if you want, and then I could watch my movies on there. I used to have one of those. What was it called? Some kind of Sony handheld device that you could watch pornography on. I don't know. They intend to launch their first electric vehicle in North America by 2025. And that their ultimate goal is for fully self-driving vehicles. I, you know, honestly, the Honda name here is the, you know, when they say, like, oh, we're going to compete against Tesla. I feel like Honda is already pretty good at making cars. When you get a Honda car and you go and you push on various pieces of it, you don't see how poorly fucking put together it is like you do on a lot of Teslas. So, like, yeah, you could put a PS5 in there. You could do all that sort of stuff. But also,
you could just make a quality automobile. I want to own an electric car. I feel like I am in a situation where maybe my next car could be an electric car. And I would like to see continued competition in that space for better electric cars, because I am probably not going to buy a Tesla. Handful of years ago, there may have been a time when I've been like, yeah, I guess I could see getting a Tesla, but I have just seen too much out of the build quality of those cars. I've seen too much out of fucking like their weird fantasy fucking self-driving stuff and how cavalier they are with some of that, that I do not trust that brand to deliver a safe automobile. Period. There is a stink on those cars for a variety of reasons, and I do not trust them. So yeah, I don't know that I would I don't know that I would find myself in the market for a Tesla automobile at this stage. So yes, any news about other car companies getting into making fancy electric cars and all that sort of stuff, like, yeah, let's get that market hot. Let's get that market competitive, because I would like a car that actually looks cool and not like some kind of fucking low poly disaster vehicle. Fuck those things. And that's on the reel. Wrestling. Boy, oh boy, wrestling, huh? How about it? Hell of a show over the weekend. AEW had their pay-per-view Full Gear. I thought it was a pretty fun show. You know, I think that AEW has got some pretty interesting storylines going, and I like their talent, and I like watching them perform, and I had a good time watching that show, and I'll continue to watch that show. They also took the opportunity with a pay-per-view happening to release a new trailer for AEW Fight Forever, their first video game, their first wrestling video game. They also took this opportunity to push the game officially into 2023. The game had originally just been like, ah, it's coming out 2022, coming out pretty soon. And so they finally said, like, yeah, it's coming out next year. At the end of that trailer is some new art. A lot of people are getting hung up on the box art for this game because it had CM Punk front and center on it. And if you are not following this specific fucking weird aspect of wrestling, the last time AEW had a pay-per-view, CM Punk ran his mouth at a press conference and talked a lot of shit, and then that led to a backstage altercation of sorts between CM Punk and one of his guys and Kenny Omega and some other folks. And Kenny Omega was sporting a bite mark on his arm around TGS, and very silly shit. Everyone got suspended for a length of time, and now everyone is back except for CM Punk and his boy Ace Steel. So they are not officially gone from the company and blah, 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 blah. CM Punk was front and center in the box art for that game. And it seems like the way the wind is blowing is that, you know, Ace Steel, CM Punk's trainer guy that had been with the company for a little bit, is no longer with the company. CM Punk is still technically, you know, they haven't said anything otherwise. That he is not with the company, so let's assume that he isn't still with the company until we've heard otherwise. But it seems potentially likely that he will never appear for the company ever again. So it got weird that he was the front and center person on this box art. They have not released new box art, but they have released new key art, and that key art is used at the end of this trailer, and it's got a much wider variety of wrestlers in it. They've gone ahead and said that the game is going to have over 50 wrestlers in it. Yes, the press release that came out for this game talking about the new trailer came with a link to assets, and in that assets folder was another folder marked box shots, and that folder is now just empty. But the new key art does have Kenny Omega front and center, along with MJF, Hangman Adam Page, Chris Jericho, John Moxley, Britt Baker, Jade Cargill, Sting, Orange Cassidy, and Brian Danielson. They've confirmed a handful of additional characters for the game as well. And we'll see where that all nets out and all of that sort of stuff. This whole CM Punk situation is just so dumb. And the Young Bucks, who are the people along with Kenny Omega that form a group called The Elite, they all produce a YouTube vlog called Being The Elite that was also suspended for, you know, a couple of months there when everyone was off and all this stuff. And I watched that thing sparingly because it has some other folks that I do like on it from time to time, but I feel like the Young Bucks are really good at being as shitty as possible in a situation, if that makes any sense. Where like part of that video is them filming the crowd while the crowd is shouting fuck CM Punk, and they left that in the video, which just seems like a childish fucking thing to do. And you know, they're updating their Twitter bio all the time, and they're like, oh, we're wrestling in Chicago, that should be interesting, that's where CM Punk is from, and so on and so forth. And it's like, just fucking drop it and move on. Make your fucking money. Like, just try to fucking move on. But that video series was always like them flipping off the camera while looking in mirrors. And like the last one I watched was like them complaining about being on the road until 3 a.m. and not getting to the hotel until late and so on and so forth and all this other stuff. And it was just like, why are you putting this out publicly for fans to watch? Like, there's a right way to do a video that's like, man, the road is long, a lot of hours. But to be basically super shitty when that's not your on-screen character for the wrestling promotion per se, you just look at it and go like, this doesn't seem like the best way to present any of this. And maybe fucking grow up just 5%, especially in this fucking weird, seemingly volatile situation. Maybe just fucking don't on this one. Like these are guys that are referred to as executive vice presidents and all this other stuff at the company, so they hold some amount of sway. And so the idea that they are potentially in some kind of position of power and also acting completely fucking shitty like this is just like, why this is not a good idea. This is not a good look. Even if you fucking hate that dude, which I get it. Not the right way to handle it. Just fucking let the shit go. Just let this shit fucking go away. I don't know. It's fucking weird. Anyway, that's your fucking wrestling update. I thought that the actual wrestling show that they put on over the weekend, I thought was a lot of fun. Those guys came back and wrestled for the first time in a couple of months. And though I think that the way that they were kind of reintroduced to television was done in a very confusing way that just expected everyone to kind of know all this backstage shit, even though that stuff never made its way into the television program. A bizarre thing. Kenny Omega looked better than he did when he was back a couple of months ago. Looked like he got some more time off to actually heal up for real, and that was really great. And then they went on, now Kenny Omega is going to wrestle Will Ospreay at Wrestle Kingdom for New Japan, and that's pretty exciting. And it made me come to a realization. I'm sorry, we have to fucking talk about wrestling, god damn it, because there's a video out of Kenny Omega issuing this challenge to Will Ospreay for Wrestle Kingdom, or basically like announcing the match. And he's sitting on this throne and he's got his fucking glasses on and he's speaking in Japanese because he's a fluent Japanese speaker, seemingly. He lived there for a while when he was wrestling for them, all this stuff. And it made me realize that Kenny Omega is so good in a Japanese promotion because he comes off like he comes off like an anime villain. all of the shit that he says, like when he's in the fucking ring holding a guy over his head and saying, you can't escape, and then doing a move to them, when he's fucking saying, you know, good night, goodbye, man, you know, like all that stuff. It's just, he comes across like the fucking perfect villain, the perfect big, larger than life character for a Japanese audience. And like watching that video, I was like, oh my God, this dude is fucking so good at this shit. And you don't see any of that in AEW. Because he does all the same stuff, sort of. But it kind of doesn't work as well. Because he's just like, yeah, I don't know, I'm part of the elite. I'm hanging out with the Young Bucks and I'm doing my thing and we're badass. But in this Japanese language thing, that the video that he cut, and you know, for this Wrestle Kingdom match, it was this reminder of just like, oh man, all his shit just works so much better in that context. And I think, he's had amazing matches in AEW, all that other stuff. But I think just like character-wise, character work, storytelling-wise, all that other stuff, I think a lot of the things that make up his character just seemed to play better in that format. And it was something that it was just like a reminder of just like, oh, right. Like when I first discovered, when I first heard of Kenny Omega and first started watching his matches and stuff like that, it was when he was in New Japan. And it, right, you know, just like that dude just like jumps off the fucking screen. You know, when everything's firing on all cylinders, like that dude just stands out in a way that is like fucking just feels impossible. It's just unbelievable. You're like, man, that dude is fucking so good at every aspect of this stuff. And he cares about every little bit and piece of the storytelling and all this other stuff. And then in AEW, it's like he's in a trios tournament and they're going to have amazing matches. They're going to go on to have a best of seven series with Death Triangle and fucking like those guys are going to have fucking tear the fucking roof off the fucking place. Good ass fucking matches for a month or more with that stuff. It's going to be awesome. But Kenny Omega in AEW is missing that spark, that extra level. And I hope that we find a way to see more of that on that stuff, because that's where he shows up more often than not. And all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I don't know. It was something I realized watching that video. Anyway, I blacked out, and then suddenly 40 minutes had passed. What did we talk about? Did we talk about wrestling? I guess we talked about wrestling. Did I get to talk to him much when he was in that E3 sketch a few years back? No, we were pretty much. So that was super last minute. We knew we were going to have Austin Creed come in, and we were pretty sure we were getting Kenny. And I remember a lot of that stuff came together super fucking fast. And the whole bit of like him, you know, like the robe and all the other stuff was just in the other room. Like we used to rent out the room across the hallway from our meeting space, the hotel room, because we needed a bathroom for guests to use. And so over there was a bathroom, and sometimes people would just hang out in that room and do whatever. But he went over there, and I guess while he was there, they found that there was a robe and all this other stuff. So they're like, oh shit, well, let's do this. And like very quickly came up with that bit, and then coming up with the bit of just like one of them getting up and the other sitting down, like all that sort of stuff was all that. That was largely them. Like I was just like, yeah, okay, yes, let's do this. Okay, yes, this all sounds good. I will say this here and we will do this. And yeah. But that all kind of came to me. I think Dan was kind of, because I was doing the previous segment. I was in the middle of interviewing people when those guys got there. And so it was like, I was like looking around going, holy shit, there's a lot of fucking shit going on in this hotel, in this room right now. And so I think Dan was with them kind of figuring out that bit. So I think what happened is like, as soon as we broke, Dan came up and said, all right, we're going to do this. I'm like, okay, cool. All right. No problem. I shook hands, met everybody real quick, and then yeah, they kind of came into the thing, and then took off, because obviously people want to go do other stuff and go to dinner or whatever. So yeah, absolutely, it was super fun. This story, this story comes to us from a site I have never heard of before, and I want to say that up front because this is information that I have not seen reported on a site that I have heard of, and so we have to kind of take it with a grain of salt, but the asset looks accurate to me in terms of knowing what these types of assets tend to look like. The headline is, PlayStation bans shovelware and easy platinum games on the PlayStation Store. Comes to us from a site called dex.exe. And basically it sounds like that a letter went out to all developers, and you know, I don't know if this is on the developer portal that Sony maintains. It looks like it. There's a screenshot of the image here, and I'm like, yeah, that kind of looks, having seen other stuff from Sony's kind of intranet or whatever, I am like that is what those pages look like. And so some anonymous source sent this image to dex.exe.com. And it basically is a page about spam and duplicative content. And there's some quotes here. SIE strives to ensure that customers can search and discover the full breadth of experiences on PlayStation, and that partners have a fair means of being discovered. When partners oversaturate or spam PlayStation Store with many variants of the same type of content, it can negatively impact both the customer and partner experience. So I don't know if you've seen this lately. I bought one of these because I was like, fuck it, let's get another platinum for $3. And I know it's a nightmare thing, but I was like, eh, fuck it. Like, it's a situation where a company, a guy, whatever, you know, a guy that is a company, whatever we want to call it, puts together some absolute shit version of Flappy Birds and then publishes it to the store 5 different times under the name, like, Platy Bird 1, Platy Bird 2, Platy Bird 3, each with its own set of trophies, each with its own platinum trophy. And so basically it's shitty, low-effort content that has a platinum, because at some point Sony relaxed the restrictions around what types of games could have a platinum trophy. And so lunatics, of which there are enough to probably make that profitable endeavor, will go and buy all 5 of those things, and then maybe even go buy them over again in the European region, and then maybe go buy them all over again in Argentina region, you know, however many regions they can get, however many different platinums they can get. And it's a bad thing. I don't know where you draw the line. Sony, apparently, if we take this at face value and assume that the source is good, because again, I've never heard of this website before, so that's the only thing. But this also seems like something that Sony would do if I had a little bit more time. I have a couple of people that I could have checked in with on this, but did not have time, to make sure that this is actually authentic. Partner requirements and allowances. When SIE reviews the content submitted to PlayStation Store, products that have the following characteristics are identified as spam or repetitive content. Products whose functionality and or assets are copied or are not meaningfully different from products already published on PlayStation Store, irrespective of the publisher of record. So that means if you clone someone else's game, or if you are a person who has set up 20 different companies to try to spam the store, they don't care. Multiple concepts and product variants published by individual partners that have duplicative functionality or experiences differentiated only by minor variances of functionality or assets. So, like, basically a lot of the low-end cheap shit that has been clogging up the PlayStation Store a little bit lately, they are looking to crack down on it. When possible, partners should consider aggregating small, similar content experiences into a single product using in-game commerce to expand or extend the experience. As an example, and this is where, supplying different trophies for each product is not enough to differentiate content. So basically saying, like, yeah, if you just have, like, oh, each game has different trophies, like, that's not enough. If any of the devs break these things mentioned above, Sony PlayStation has said that in the letter about the actions in place. And then there's more quotes from the document here. Content or partners found to have breached policy may be subject to the following enforcement actions. Content excluded from PlayStation Store merchandising. Discoverability on PlayStation Store is restricted. Content does not feature in automatic merchandising placements, such as the new releases strand. Content delisted from PlayStation Store. Content is not searchable and can only be accessed via direct link on web and mobile stores. Impact on cert ops process. Content is not permitted to proceed to publication until policy violations are rectified. Review slot availability is affected. Content takedown. Content is removed from PlayStation Store until policy violations are rectified. PlayStation Partners account suspension or termination. Multiple rejections or takedowns may result in the suspension or eventual termination of a partner's PlayStation Partners account. Termination of an account results in the removal of all content from the PlayStation Store. So, yeah, this, again, I cannot vouch for the absolute authenticity of that document, but it looks... It looks reasonable for me, having seen a little bit of kind of leaked PlayStation kind of partner website stuff before. That is sort of what that looks like. And also, it seems like a policy that Sony would attempt to roll out and try to handle this and you know, stop people from submitting 20 different versions of the same game over and over again. Not that the PlayStation Store is good. Not that if you solve this, like, the PlayStation Store is suddenly, like, awesome. You know? Like, it's got larger issues. I think discoverability on the on-console, the PlayStation 5 version of the PlayStation Store still kind of sucks. It's better than it was at launch. When that store launched, it was a disaster. And didn't update for the longest time. Like, there were just, like, pages. There were strands on the page that just did not update on a regular basis. It was very poor functionality. So I could see them very much wanting to do this. This is something I like. This last batch of games, I know Greg Miller, who is the biggest trophy weirdo I know, was out there talking about them a little bit, and that led to me going like, I'm going to buy one of these because I want to see one of these in action. And it is a very shitty little Flappy Birds clone. And you get the platinum trophy by clearing like 20, by getting like 20 points or something, by playing it for like under a minute. You've got all the trophies and platinum trophy in that thing. And so, you know, it's clearly just there in multiple territory. I think they even did a PS4 version of it. So like you could probably go buy the PlayStation 4 version, the PlayStation 5 version of these five different games. So that's 10 right there. And then if you had different regions that you could use to go buy it out of the European store and all sorts of stuff, that's 10 more there. So you could probably get a bunch of really dark, shitty platinum trophies off these games. If you wanted to go that route, like I said, I got one, I don't know. But that's, you know, the early days of Xbox achievements definitely had games like that, you know, like, I think you got the full 1,000. Well, this is different, right? Because when King Kong came out at launch, the achievements were not... You had to play the game. You had to finish the game. But I think the deal was, if you finished that game, you got all 1,000 points. But you had to finish the game. And it's a bad game. But it wasn't like it was a 20-minute game. But there were situations where, like, you know, there would be... You would get 200 achievement points for... like looking at the menu in NBA Live or, you know, whatever it was. They were just like the early days of Xbox achievements were really very different than the way they are now. And there were a lot of very dumb early achievements because just, you know, no one had used them before. So no one was really sure what to do and how to make it work. I remember Dead Rising had the maximum number of achievements and each achievement was just 20 points because that equaled 1,000, right? Yes. 50 achievements. 20 points of 1,000. Anyway, and so there were things in Dead Rising that were damn near impossible to do, and you would do them and it would only be 20 points because every achievement was just 20 points. And you're like, this is bad too. Yeah, it took a long time for I think developers to make sense of the achievement stuff. And now, you know, I don't know, they still care about it, but I think it's just kind of I don't know. Yeah, I feel like a lot of games are missing inventive achievements these days. But I haven't, I don't know. I don't keep as close a track as that stuff as I used to either. So, yeah. This Mick Gordon thing is a mess. I don't I don't even know where to begin with this. It's around the Doom Eternal soundtrack. And this started years ago. I remember hearing about this stuff a very long time ago, and Eurogamer kind of has a timeline of it, because back in 2020, Marty Stratton of id got on Reddit to kind of the way Eurogamer puts it is to address speculation and criticism surrounding the game's soundtrack's release and admitting to eroded trust between Gordon and id Software. And then Mick Gordon last week wrote a book on Medium about it, looking to, you know, basically rebut all of Marty's claims, and says that they offered him a six-figure settlement to never talk about it again, but instead of taking that, he wanted to get out there and tell the truth about this stuff because they tried to basically buy his silence and all of this sort of stuff. But basically, they announced a soundtrack before they had even told Mick Gordon they were going to be released, like a separate sellable soundtrack, before they'd even told Mick Gordon that they were going to make it. And, you know, making music for a game, especially one that has a little bit of dynamic music in it itself, then translating that onto a CD or however you're going to sell it, is a bit of a process. You know, you're going to want to like think about those songs in a different context if you're making them for pure listening. And so that is some work, but I am not going to like recap everything that Mick Gordon has had to say about it, because again, he wrote a lot. A lot. And he's got what look like receipts for all of it. And talking about the work on the project and how some of his music that he thought wasn't going to end up in the game did end up in the game, and all this sort of stuff, how he was paid for X number of hours of music, but they actually used more than they were supposed to, and this and that. And, you know, there's just a lot of stuff. It sounds like it was a very difficult process for all involved to make the music happen, and that he's got screenshots of emails and with Marty kind of coming off like a bit of a jerk on some of this stuff. So the latest in this is that Bethesda has issued a statement about it as well. It's a screenshot posted to Twitter, so you know it's legit. And again, Bethesda probably didn't need to say anything here. It's a weird. I'm not going to read the whole thing. The recent post by Mick Gordon both mischaracterized and misrepresented the team at id Software, the development of a Doom Eternal, Marty Stratton, and Chad Mossholder with a one-sided and unjust account of an irreparable professional relationship. We are aware of all the details and history in this matter, and unequivocally support Marty, Chad, and the team at id Software. Gee. We reject the distortion of the truth and selective presentation of incomplete facts. And they put facts in quotes. So, like, whoever wrote this was fucking... This comes off as whoever wrote this was pissed. And it's like, well, fuck you. Like, well, how about fuck you? We stand ready with full and complete documented evidence to disclose in an appropriate venue as needed. The statements posted online have incited harassment and threats of violence against Marty, Chad, and the id Software team. Any threats of harassment directed towards members of our team will be met with swift and appropriate action to protect their health and safety. We remain incredibly proud of id's previous collaborations with Mick Gordon and ask that fans refrain from reaching conclusions based on his account and, more importantly, from attacking any of the individuals mentioned on either side, including Marty, Chad, or Mick. I'm sure that this, you know, that there probably was some amount of harassment on this, because it's the 90s, y'all. It's 2022, y'all, and that anything you say on anything, there's harassment attached to it now. So, people saying they think that Marty wrote this, I don't. I don't think that's the case, personally. I think it would come from higher up the Bethesda chain than that, personally. But anyway, this is, you know, of course, Bethesda is going to stand with their people. And it's, you know, sure, yeah, you should. A company should stand with their people, you know, at least publicly, while they're digging through this and going, what the fuck did you do? Why did you fucking, why did this fucking blow up like this? Why are we here? What happened here? What the fuck is going on? And yeah, I don't know. There was a similar kind of anger around some, I guess, some of the Modern Warfare 2 music being reused for soundtrack. And so some of the, one of the people who had done music for that game had said that she was never going to work with them again on that. So there seems to be a little bit of this going around, but, yeah, I don't know. It's Bethesda posting a statement that says, like, oh, we've got the facts and we're ready to disclose them if needed. Is just like such a weird, like, gun on the table type of just like, well, we've got this here. If you really want to go for this, we can go for this. And that just seems like a really shitty way to act. I don't know. Like, even if they feel wronged by what Mick Gordon has said, and even in the event that Bethesda actually is in the right here, I don't think it does them any good. Like, you stand by your people, you say don't harass anyone, sure. But I think to say, to put facts in scare quotes, and I think to say that you've got documented evidence ready to disclose in an appropriate venue as needed just sounds like, I mean, it's a threat is what that is. You don't need to do that. Especially if you want this to go away, you just don't need to do that. Even if you've got it, you don't need to present it like this and be like, oh, we're not going to tell you what it is, but we've got it. Like, well, fuck you. Like, what? How am I supposed to believe? Yeah, it's just, it seems like that this relationship went super south over this soundtrack stuff, and it sounds like that Doom Eternal's development was maybe rough all over, and when things are going rough internally, it becomes very easy to, I think, forget some of your external people and how they're handling things and all this stuff, because you are in the center of the fire. I'm not trying to excuse how they may have treated Mick Gordon over this and some of the language and some of the emails that Mick has posted, especially for something that is separate from the game, like a separate soundtrack, which is important and has to get done because you've started taking pre-orders for it, which is a dumb move. I don't know. This, nothing Bethesda has said gives me any reason to go, oh, those poor guys. Like, this just seems like Mick Gordon got fucked. You understand how something like this happens because, again, he's an external contributor. And if Doom Eternal is going off the rails internally and you're desperately trying to get it back on track, then, like, having fucking conversations about, like, the soundtrack CD, you're like, what the fuck am I even doing? Like, I could see being in a situation where you're just like, I am fucking unhappy. Like, where a person like a Marty Stratton might be like, yeah, fucking, I've got 30 more important things to fucking worry about right now than this fucking thing. Like, you know. But that doesn't excuse it. I just understand how something like that might happen and how Mick Gordon might be treated this way and all of this other stuff. Especially also, yes, one of the little fact, the bits in here is that before the album was released, Gordon had learned that the album had been in development or that it had been taking his music and turning it into the album for about 6 months. Before he even was aware that it had been worked on, and he was not happy with stuff that the audio designer was doing to his music and all this other stuff. And this is a shit situation. And I guess if and when they do make another Doom, probably going to have a different sounding soundtrack then, huh? Unfortunate. But then I think there are a lot of things about Doom Eternal that are a little unfortunate. So what are you going to do? That's it for the news. Why don't we get into some emails? You know, it's been, gosh, the internet, huh? It's been a real, it's been a real disaster lately. I signed up for another social media service a couple of days ago. It is called Hive, and it is Twitter-esque, and I don't think it's a particularly amazing service, but it is the most Twitter-esque one of them out there right now, and it's a weird thing happened, I think, over the last 72 hours. It's slowing down a little bit now. It was really, like, yesterday. It was really, like, Sunday and Monday. I don't know how this happened. I guess this is just, like, word of mouth. Like, things travel virally. Like, it feels like a gigantic swath of the people on Twitter who work at video game companies just went and moved over to Hive. Like a lot of them. You know, there's been, you know, people have signed up for co-host. I like co-host a lot, but it's much more Tumblr-like. It is much more of a blog type of platform. It is great for longer things, and gigantic images and CSS wizardry and all this really cool shit. I love go to cohost.org. Hell of a website. I think it's great. But it's not Twitter. You know, it's not a microblogging service the way Twitter was originally billed. And Hive is a lot closer to that. And so it really just seemed like I guess like everyone just must have looked at it and said, like, oh, this looks like Twitter. Yeah, we should move over here. And so like a lot of like I signed up for Glenn Rubenstein was the first person that I saw saying like, oh, I'm just checking out this Hive thing. And I was like, oh, fucking, I don't know, man. I don't want to sign up for it. And I was like, finally I signed up for it. And I was like, whatever. Another one of these, of course I signed up for it. And then it felt like I went and I played some Call of Duty. I got out into the DMZ and I stole a bunch of jumper cables and comic books out of the DMZ. And then I looked down at my phone and it felt like half of the video game industry had signed up for Hive in that hour. I don't know what the fuck happened. It was just like this very sudden, like, oh my God, what? And like, it was like, oh, like now, and it's not just people. It's like brands and stuff too. Like there's an IGN account on Hive. Stuff that just seems like really, like a bunch of Microsoft folks set up accounts over there. Like, you know, Major Nelson's posting stuff on there. And a lot of the, you know, other folks from there, you know, some Sony folks have signed up. It's just like, it felt like a much greater shift than any of the stuff that's happened, you know, like, cause obviously I think people have their problems with Mastodon. I think Mastodon is like functional and it's not that hard. Like people that are like, it's so hard to understand. It's not, it's really not. Minor differences, but you know, also I think a lot of the attitudes on Mastodon are not going to be conducive to a lot of the, you know, commercial related nature of people's posts and stuff like that. Like, you know, Mastodon is trying to be that kind of open source, like, no, man, we're about people, bro. And you're like, okay, cool. But like not enough people. And so it was weird to see all of this stuff just kind of happen. At first I was like, what is driving this? Like, was there some weird investment made? Has this been the big play all along? Cause you always figure like as Twitter started to like fucking go up in smoke and as Twitter continues to just be like a fucking bummer. And also a thing that you look at and go like, this keeps getting worse and worse in ways that are not a thing that a brand might feel safe advertising on or posting to or all this other stuff. And it seems to be just kind of getting worse as time goes on. I see why everyone would be looking for the next thing. Of course, like everyone's been looking for the next thing for a couple of weeks now. And you know, you always figure like, oh, well, hey, some big tech idiot is going to come up with something and launch it real soon now. And I still think that'll happen even with Hive out there, that suddenly there's just going to be like, oh, here's a, here's another one of these services. Let's check it out. It's backed. It's well built. Blah blah blah. All this other stuff. But until that happens, everyone seems to be flocking to Hive, and it's mobile only, which is, you know, a bit of a hassle for people who don't want to use their phone. But also apparently it's run by two people. But there's been a lot of, like, I don't know. There's other people claiming that it is like venture capital backed and not as down home as maybe it seems. And whereas Co-host very much is a small crew of people doing things in a very deliberate way. And I like that about Co-host. But I don't know. There's a lot of weird talk around Hive as well, but also it is very much a Twitter like service, and a ton of people moved over there. And it's weird to see it happen, like, kind of all at once. It's not to say that those people aren't still posting to Twitter or anything like that, but it's like people seem to be itching, yearning for something that is Twitter, but is not on Twitter. You know what I mean? Like, people are desperately looking for that next thing, wherever it is. And all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I don't know. Hive seems fine. It's it has the ability to ask questions and stuff like that, sort of like Tumblr, which is kind of cool. And all that. It was just very strange to just like look down at my phone and be like, oh, holy shit. Like, normally I am the boneheaded dope that is just like, fuck it, I'll sign up for another social media thing, and then, like, you know, a handful of others. But it felt like this all at once thing of just like, oh my gosh. Like, there's like another 60 people I know that I followed on Twitter that are like, you know, video game people, you know, like, it just became like suddenly like, oh man, like a lot of the people that I would want to hear from are now on this service. And that's, it was just fucking crazy to see. So I don't know. It's interesting, you know, and now they're up over a million signups and all this stuff. Like, it's very interesting to watch the way that these trends happen and the way it all works. And will Hive be the end all be all for the next 20 years? Like, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, probably not. I'm going to say like, they'll probably be something else before everyone truly does settle back down again. I'm not convinced that Hive will actually be the thing, but, yeah, I don't know. Just a very, very strange thing. Anyway, I'm on Hive. I guess follow me on Hive, I guess. I don't know. And also send in some emails to podcast@guard.bike. That's the email address that you can use to contact me and so on and so forth. As Mike from Manchester has, he says, a couple of weeks ago, you were talking about AEW Fight Forever. And now Cody Rhodes and CM Punk will probably still be in the game despite no longer being a part of the product. This brings to mind the WWF Warzone Strategy Guide, which had a lengthy section about the development of the game, where the developers said they had to fight to keep Bret Hart, Ahmed Johnson, and the British Bulldog in the game after they left to join WCW. As well as this, I remember hearing that WWE were not happy about Rob Van Dam and Sabu being in Legends of Wrestling while ECW was now a part of WWE's television. Is there a generally agreed time a developer can use a likeness they no longer own before release, or is it just a calculation to make on how likely it is you're going to get sued? No. So none of this is like, let's just use it anyway. We probably won't get sued. This is all like written into these contracts and stuff, like, hey, the likeness rights extend into, like, so presumably, like, AEW owns the likeness rights to Cody Rhodes and CM Punk while they are part of the company. But part of the break clause, or, you know, whatever, if that contract doesn't renew, is that anything made, I'm going to say, any kind of deal made prior to that is probably still good. And so you end up in a situation of just like, oh, yeah, well, when this game started development, Cody Rhodes was a part of the company and his likeness was still a part of the thing. And so they would still be in the clear to use that stuff. They don't have to, but they can. And because of the amount of work that goes into making an individual character and all this other stuff, like, it's better to just use it than not, right? If it's most of the way done, you're like, well, we might as well just keep them in there. Otherwise, we don't have time to go add a whole new wrestler to this game in lieu of that. it's either we finish him up or we just cut it completely and there's one fewer character in this game. So at that point, you might as well just do it. And that's why I think that even, let's assume that the CM Punk contract is still, like, he's still signed to AEW in some fashion, presumably. We haven't heard otherwise. But let's assume that they are working on a way to get out of that contract, and if they're going to pay him off or pay, you know, or whatever the break clause is, I would assume that they would still retain enough likeness rights to keep him in that game if they wanted to. And they should. Don't put him on the cover, but yeah, put him in the video game. Absolutely. Why wouldn't you? And so the idea that the developers had to, like, fight to keep Bret Hart, Ahmed Johnson, and the British Bulldog in WWF Warzone, that fight was probably with the WWE, or I guess WWF at the time, and not with contract lawyers or anything. That was probably WWF being like, no, those guys, goddamn, pal, those guys aren't with our company anymore. Get them the fuck out of here. And then you sit down and explain to them, like, okay, we can do that. But then this game's only going to have fucking 8 people in it or whatever, because on this timetable, we don't have enough time to go add 3 new people to this game. So either you let us keep these guys in here because the work is done, or we just spitefully rip it out, and that's that. And so at some point, you know, cooler heads prevail, and you're like, oh, right, yeah, I guess we should do that. And to this day, every time a WWE game comes out, like, the roster is of varying degrees out of date. That's because they have to lock those rosters months before that game comes out, because there's a lot of work to do to get those people into that game. And so if in the middle of that, someone's contract expires and they leave, or if someone's gimmick changes, which, you know, and they can sometimes accommodate that stuff, but not all the time. If someone goes from, like, oh, well, now my name isn't Elias, now it's Zeke. You're like, shit, well, okay, we need to record all the VO for the announcers. We need to record all this other stuff to try to accommodate this change. You've got a slightly different look, so we need to touch up the model to change the hair, to do this, to take the beard off, to do this. And so, you know, there ends up just being like, and that would be like a relatively minor change in the grand scheme of things. If someone's character changes, like, completely dramatically, and it's a whole, you know, a whole different type of wrestling move set, which is not, doesn't happen all the time, but, like, you know, that'd be much harder to deal with. And you just go, like, fuck it, we locked the roster before this guy changed into this other character, so whatever. Or, like, hey, this guy went out and bleached his hair. It used to be that, you know, because they were doing action figures and all this other stuff, that the WWF wanted to have not only likeness rights, but also control over your likeness, to where they would say, like, goddamn, pal, don't go get a haircut, because we're selling action figures and t-shirts and all this other stuff, and you look like this. So if you go cut your hair short and come in looking like this, all that shit looks obsolete. So don't fucking do it. For those very reasons, because they'd have those figures in development and all this other stuff. And so it just would just make sense to maintain that, really. And yeah. Let's see here. Aaron in Connecticut writes in and says, they sent in 2 emails. We'll take them both. Gears of War is now older than Super Mario World was when Gears of War was released. We are so, so old. That truly is crazy. And it really, like, I had to look, because that doesn't seem proper. But that seems to line up. Yes. It's weird, because that doesn't feel like, I mean, I think the situation here is weird, because, like, Super Mario World is such a different old game. 2D, side-scrolling. all that other stuff. But you look at Gears of War 1 and it still looks like the way, I mean, obviously it's a step down in graphics. Like, let's not, you know, let's not be crazy, but it is still identifiable as a modern video game. Like if they, when they put out a Gears of War game, Gears 5 and Gears 1, you look at them, you go, yeah, no, those look of the same thing. Whereas you take Super Mario World and Mario 64 and you go like, oh, those are the same characters, but holy shit, that's a vastly different thing. And really what it underscores is just that video game technology has not advanced in the same way that it used to since Gears of War 1's release, you know? But even Gears of War 1 was a 360 game, and so it still had its online play and still had all that other stuff. And so in a lot of cases, Gears of War 1 is still a modern feeling video game, is still a modern video game because it does all of the same type of stuff. Online co-op and competitive and whatever, right? Like all that stuff. And they didn't wait till Gears 2 to add competitive, right? It was all in there from the start, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong. But like, you know, the transition from 2D to 3D was stark. And you look at games from the before time and the after time, and they look dramatically different. Whereas you look at games from the early polygonal days of PlayStation 1 through, you know, PlayStation 2 and 3 era, and, you know, games still kind of look like that. A lot of PlayStation 1 games are really, and Saturn games are actually super fucking fucked and hard to go back to because controllers have changed. You got to remember that like the vast majority of PlayStation games did not support analog sticks. And so a lot of movement in 3D space was, by today's standards, totally garbage. And so that was one of the last, that was a big update. But then a lot of it since then has been stuff that kind of seems under the hood. Like if you look at screenshots of the games, it's not immediately hard to tell, right? Because it's, you know, the games are still polygonal, textured polygons, all that other stuff. The changes after that, the changes that the 360 brought us were all online infrastructure based and the sorts of modes that we could get into on that sort of stuff. And, but also like the things we've seen since have been advancements along those same lines. Online has gotten richer and more in-depth and in some ways more intrusive, depending on your viewpoint on some of those games. Obviously, the graphics and sound have gotten better. You know, and that has led to richer, larger environments. You know, the last Gears was almost an open-zone Sonic Frontiers kind of game in a way that Gears 1 probably never could have done with that tech and at that time. And so you see those sorts of differences, but you know, screenshot to screenshot, you just go like, yeah, I don't know, man, that's a guy in a do-rag with a fucking gun with a chainsaw on it hiding behind some waist-high wall, and across the way is a bunch of monsters. Like, that's still exactly what it looks like, because that's still exactly what it is. But I don't, you know, I don't mean to say that nothing has happened and there's no innovation in games or any of that other bullshit. It's just that the innovation in games happens in different ways. And in some ways happens in ways that are negative to consumers. You know, a lot of that innovation has taken the form of like, you know, again, you're going to have different perspectives on this, but it's taken the form of live service games and the way we sell games, the way that games, the way that people get their hands on games and interact with them and buy them or don't buy them and don't have to buy them, all that sort of stuff. Like those sorts of changes have happened. And in some ways, that's innovative. Aaron also wrote in and said, Dead Space is now about as old as Super Metroid was when Dead Space came out. Yeah. 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 I don't know. I think, you know, some people thought that virtual reality would end up being like a big, that would be the next sea change, right? That would be the, like, games are never going to be the same again. And that's just not the case. You know, VR is carving out its own corner and it's going to continue to exist and all that sort of stuff, but it's not, it is not going to change games the way that, that maybe we initially thought it could. Or at least if it is, it's going to happen slowly. It's not going to be the like, oh my God, everything that happened before this is a child's toy. Look at all this stuff, you know, like all that sort of stuff. Like, yeah, it's weird, man. I don't know. It doesn't like that sort of stuff doesn't feel good when you think about it, right? The idea that like, man, the innovation in video games is getting harder to see. And when you explain it, sometimes it comes with those caveats, right? It's not, it used to be very pure in terms of just like, oh, well, I mean, now these graphics are polygonal and this is crazy. Or like, oh, now we've got online integrated in such a way that we can just get online and have these shared experiences and competitive play and all this other stuff. And, you know, but then everything after that has been like, okay, well, like, yeah, now this game is free to play, free to start, but you can also purchase additional content, or, hey, you can buy this game at full price, but now you can purchase additional content that is not just an expansion the way PC games used to do. And so all those things, I think, are innovative, and all those things can be ways that, like, games are presented in different ways. Like, players on a budget are eating fucking great, right? I mean, players that don't want to spend a lot of money on video games, there's so much out there for them. And I think it's very easy for, you know, a lot of players that have been playing games for a long time to ignore that. But, like, honestly, the idea that you can play a lot of those games for free and that there are those types of experiences are now coming to phones in a lot of cases as well. Like there's such a huge shift in terms of like how people engage with the medium, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And that they can do it in a much more casual way if they so choose and not spend a dime. Other than buying the hardware and all that sort of stuff, they may already own it. They may not. I think that stuff is, it's very easy to overlook in terms of just like, oh, well, the games just look the same now. They just look a little, they're just 5% prettier and then they ship them out again. It's like, yeah, sure, but not really. It's just a much more complicated thing than that. But it's also, it's a complicated thing that is very hard to explain to the layman, right? In a way that sounds like a positive thing, because it isn't always positive. You know, some of the innovations happen on the business side. And while there are sometimes positive outcomes there, it's you know, not always, right? Tom writes in and says, so someone said that Sonic Frontiers is a Strand game, and I said it's not, but Tom says Sonic Frontiers should be a Strand game. Community-built rails and courses littered over the open world is what Sonic Frontiers needs. It should be a Strand game. The more broken, the better. Totally true. Yes. I think if you could encounter a different thing every time you loaded up that zone because you were just tapping into a different, like, weird tier of user-created rails and rings and all this other stuff, I think that would be super rad and mega broken, but also that would be actually pretty fucking cool. It'd be pretty fucking cool. Let's see here. Pizza Steve writes in and says, a recent email got me thinking, I've been playing games in Japanese off of the Japanese eShop, but I want old weird stuff. Would you recommend getting a standalone FPGA system or something like a Steam Deck? I don't need pixel perfect, but something that consistently works. You know, the thing you're going to use on a Steam Deck is most likely going to be RetroArch, and RetroArch can be finicky and flaky at times, and it's, you know, like, all this stuff is under constant development, so consistently works is, it's attainable on any one of these platforms, but you will occasionally run into situations where it's like, oh, this thing that should work isn't working the way I thought it would, and all this other stuff. I would, you know, Steam Deck is going to play more platforms than your standalone FPGA system is going to. Assuming you mean the Mister here, because otherwise we're talking about, I don't know, like the analog devices generally play one system. The Analog Pocket can play a handful. But either way, there's going to be a bit of a setup process, whether it's like figuring out like, how do I name these directories and how do I get the files in the right format? And some of this stuff is not as easy as I wish it was. And like, if we're talking about playing old, weird Japanese games, you're going to eventually run out of the kind of, you know, there's plenty of 8-bit NES and 16-bit SNES games that you can emulate any which way. And there are English translations of a ton of those games, so you can make it a much more palatable experience if you so desire. But at some point, when you start getting into, I want the old weird Japanese stuff, at some point, for me anyway, I got to that point where I'm like, I really want to see PC-88 games, and I really want to see X68000 games. And I want to see all the PC-98 games, except that most of the PC-98 games are porno. I want to see what the FM Towns was capable of. And so it's a situation, I streamed a little bit of the Spectrum, the old ZX Spectrum last week. And it was a good reminder of just like, there are a lot of computers that I've never seen in real life. When it comes time to emulate a Commodore 64, I know that machine very, very well. And so when you're emulating one, I know the quirks. I know, like, this is what you type to load a game after you put the disk in the drive, because that's something you may need to know. But when you get to a BBC Micro, or when you get to a Spectrum, or when you get to, like, these computers that I have just never seen in real life, and the Sharp X1 and the Sharp X68K and a lot of those other Japanese machines, I've never seen an MSX in person, for example. And so there are things about, like, the capabilities of those platforms that I just don't know. I know the difference between a Commodore 64 and a Commodore 128, and why you don't really care about the 128. But I don't know what the difference is between a Spectrum Plus 2 and a Plus 3, and, like, I own an Amiga 500, but I don't know really what the difference between an A500 and, like, an A1200 is, or, like, what's the, like, if I want to emulate all the Amiga games, how should I configure the emulator to be the most capable? Those are things that I just don't have the expertise on for a lot of those platforms. A lot of those platforms, I don't even know how to load a fucking game. Like, I know, like, I'm emulating putting a cassette tape into a tape drive, but what do you type in to load the fucking tapes on a BBC Micro? I don't fucking know. So I have to look it up every time, you know? And that sort of documentation, I feel like emulator documentation for people who want to load and play software, that stuff isn't always as easy to find as it probably should be. And you're going to run into little bits and pieces of that, regardless of which way you go. If you get a Steam Deck and you're running RetroArch through that stuff and trying to play those systems that way, there are going to be quirks that you're going to run into there. If you're getting a Mister and building it out and all the other stuff, you're going to run into different quirks there, because it's still the same concept of, like, you know, you're mounting an image to a device, but then what? If it's a platform where the games don't automatically boot, what do you type? How do I do it? There's always going to be a little bit of a learning curve there. And so I think you could go either route. The Steam Deck is obviously going to be way more capable of doing a lot of stuff that the Mister is not, but the Mister is generally speaking going to be more accurate and more awesome. There's just something so fucking rad about the Mister, and just, it plays Congo Bongo now, you know? What more do you want? It plays PlayStation games, like, surprisingly well. Saturn is coming along. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening there, you know? But again, installing RetroArch to your PC or to a Steam Deck or whatever, I would actually recommend, honestly, I feel like if your first exposure to something like RetroArch is going to be as something that was installed to a Steam Deck, it's going to be kind of a hassle to figure out, like, where do I put files. How do I set up a directory with the right stuff to make this work? And how do I build playlists? And where do I put my games? And where do I do this? Like, there's a lot of stuff that if you have used that software on a Windows machine already and become comfortable with it, then you are going to have an easier time setting all that up on a Steam Deck. That's how it was for me. And so the hoops you have to jump through to get from like installation to a game up and running are much easier to fathom and understand and work with if you have experience with that software on a different platform. You know what I mean? So I would consider that as well. You know, just install it on PC if you've got one, and see how it goes for a little bit, and if you like that software, if you like the RetroArch stuff and want to run it on a Steam Deck, you can. It's awesome. It's really convenient. It's really fun to have that stuff portably. Yeah, the Steam Deck is much more capable at running a wider variety of RetroArch cores compared to some other handheld devices, like the Switch, for example. You can put RetroArch onto a Switch, and it does a lot of older stuff just fine, but there's just some stuff that is a lot harder to fuck with and figure out and all that stuff as well. So there's just a lot to consider when you're doing all that. So yeah. The answer is there's no easy answer when it comes to that sort of thing, I suppose. Jordan writes in and says, I was recently on 6 flights in 5 days from Scotland to San Francisco and back. Man, that's fucked. I loaded up my Steam Deck and Switch with plenty to play, but when I actually got on the plane, I found that I couldn't be bothered, couldn't get comfortable, or just felt sick. Do you game on planes, or rather, did you when you were jetting off more regularly, or did you just get drunk like a normal person? Also, I tried some Zoa. It tasted incredibly weak, barely like an energy drink. I need to find a way to get some of Scotland's finest, Nay Danger and Dragon Soup. Yeah, no, we definitely want to try some of that out. So I don't, you know, I usually try to just sit with my eyes closed on a plane. And so I will listen to music. That is usually what I do, is I will just try to like rest as best I can or something. Like, I know it's when I get back out on the road, I'm definitely going to bring my Steam Deck. I definitely want to bring all that stuff and do all that stuff. But yeah, I've definitely loaded up a bag with like, I've got an iPad with a bunch of movies on it and some games to play and books to read, and then just not touched it for, you know, days and days of flights. Because once I get on, I honestly don't like drinking on planes very much either. It's just not that fun of an experience. But I'm not one of these drunks that very easily falls asleep. I'm a drunk that is just like, all right, now what? Where are we going now? What are we doing next? Let's keep drinking, you know, like that sort of thing. So that's not a great, that's not a great experience. It's the one time I had too much to drink on a plane before I got on a plane was when I was going out to New York to see, I guess it would have been San Andreas. And I was with someone from Rockstar, and we were in the hotel bar just drinking before we got on the plane, and then got on the plane. I was just like, ugh, this is fucking terrible. And then got off the plane and started drinking again. And it was fine. I don't know. But like, I tend to not really drink alcohol on planes. But yeah, I'll bring headphones. I'll listen to music and. You know, I would usually like to play like very simple stuff. Like, I could see losing hours to just like solitaire or some dumb fucking match 3 game on your phone, or just like something that is utterly mindless. Like, the less involved the better in some ways. Just like, give me some word search game or Ken or just some dumb number game, something, you know, that I can just sit there and just go like, and listen to music while I'm doing so. That's probably my typical kind of flight experience, is just doing stupid stuff like that. Let's see here. Niv writes in and says, this is about unemulatable hardware features. You mentioned the Dreamcast as a reasonably emulatable console, and I generally agree, but it brought to mind something I think about far too often, Sonic Shuffle. Yeah, no, that's, the more time you spend thinking about Sonic Shuffle, the worse off you are as a person, I think. Mostly just notable for being a more miserable Mario Party, it did one interesting thing. It used the VMUs to show people their hands without other players seeing. It strikes me that this is something you can't quite emulate. If you put the VMU displays on screen, everyone can see them. Other examples that jump to mind are Boktai with the sun sensor, or old Xbox and PlayStation games that have pressure-sensitive buttons. Any thoughts on the problem of hardware-focused stuff that's hard to replicate in an emulated environment? Yeah, the PS2 pressure-sensitive buttons is something that comes up because you're trying to play something like an MGS2 and you don't have those pressure sensitive buttons, and so there are certain things that you can't really accomplish anymore in that game. So I guess like that's the sort of situation that if you really want to play that game, you probably buy the actual original controller and hook it up and play it that way, right? Because I imagine there must be some emulation situation like PCSX2. I bet would recognize the pressure sensitive buttons if you had them. I don't know that for sure, but. And Boktai with the sun sensor, a lot of emulators adapted just an ability for you to set what the sun sensor was seeing. Like you would just basically just like have a slider or adjust with the number of sun it was seeing. So you could turn the sun down when you needed to and turn it back up when you needed to, and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, the VMU being used for like hidden play calling and seeing your hand in Sonic Shuffle, stuff like that. Like, I don't know that any of the Dreamcast, I mean, there's always a scenario where like an emulator could theoretically speak to an actual VMU hooked up to an actual Dreamcast controller hooked up to your PC, right? That's doable. I'm sure of it. Whether it's been done or not, I don't know. But I'm sure if an emulator developer got it in their head that they very much needed to actually support real, genuine VMUs, they could probably do it. Let's see, Red Bank Johnny writes in from Red Bank, South Carolina. Say, my favorite part of the podcast is when someone would write in about an obscure game they couldn't remember and you were just able to do a knowledge dump on it. Now it's my turn to ask about a game and I hope you can help. I don't know if it's a dream or if it's a real game, so here goes nothing. Okay, let's get loose. I remember an old Laserdisc game that was out around the time of Space Ace and Dragon's Lair. It was a standard fantasy setting, but what made it different from those other two was it had a shitty membrane keyboard thing instead of a joystick like the other two. Hopefully you can ease my brain and help me out. That's Thayer's Quest, I believe. I believe that would be Thayer's Quest as the name of that game. I'm going to look it up just to make sure, but... But yeah, yes, it is Thayer's Quest is the name of that game. It had a very shitty membrane keyboard on it. And basically, I'm going to try and get an image of one of these buttons here to see. So it's like individual buttons for like Black Mace and Hunting Horn and spell of understanding. Like, there's just different buttons for each individual item that you might collect in the game. And it's a completely ridiculous concept. But, it, you know, it gives you more potential inputs than a joystick and a button did with Space Ace or Dragon's Lair. So they're trying to create something that was sort of like that adventure game kind of experience where you might have more ways to interact with the cartoon than you might have otherwise. And so it's got buttons for like yes and no and stuff like that. That was in arcades. It was also a game that was on the old RDI Halcyon, the old Rick Dyer joint, which was a Laserdisc home machine that was produced in extremely low quantities and is now extremely rare. And yeah, no, that's that game's called Thayer's Quest. There's probably a way to play Thayer's Quest in some kind of, I bet Daphne plays Thayer's Quest. I bet the emulator Daphne plays Thayer's Quest. Seems like something that would, but yeah, really silly. But it, like, just to see the cabinet, when you see the cabinet and you're like, oh my gosh, like it's a cabinet, but instead of a joystick, there's just this weird membrane keyboard. That's awfully strange. Oh, Brian in the chat says you can play it on a DVD player. So yeah, they must have done a DVD version of it. It must have done some kind of on-screen display for the keyboard or something like that. Yes, Thayer's Quest is the name of the game you were looking for. Here's an anonymous email from someone. I'm a longtime fan and couldn't help but write in after your Project Cars talk last episode. This might have been a couple episodes ago now. You mentioned Skate as a potential model for EA going forward, and I had some insight into said model due to a playtest I was involved in. That's why this is anonymous. Essentially, they showed us a PowerPoint of a player-run marketplace using real money. The whole thing felt very Diablo 3, but with real brands and false scarcity. It felt like they were going all in on an NFT marketplace without actually using the words NFT. I imagine when this is officially announced, it's going to piss a lot of people off, but it is possible with enough bad playtest feedback, they'll scrap the entire thing. I have never leaked anything, so I don't have screenshots or proof, but I figure you should know anyway. Yeah, so you don't need to use the blockchain to do false digital scarcity or any of that sort of stuff. So yeah, there's no real need for it to be NFTs or any of that other junk. And yeah, I mean, you know, the next Skate is going to be free to play, and there's going to be a lot of opportunities there for how they're going to sell stuff to you. And of course, a big part of Skate culture is all of the kind of clothing and boards and parts and all of that other stuff. And so there's a huge opportunity there for them to sell you that type of cosmetic content in a wide variety of ways, right? Whether it's like you get the girl pack and now you've got all these girl skateboards and all this t-shirts and all this other stuff, or it could just be individual shirts. And it could be a case of like, oh, hey, we've got this stuff in here, but there's only 100 for sale. Like, there's always a potential for them to try to do some artificial scarcity. And I think that's the stuff that really sucks. And also players selling to other players at that point. Like, when you've got your like, oh, this is my rare t-shirt that I bought when they were selling those. Or, you know, like, imagine if Fortnite had the ability for you to sell skins to other players for skins that don't exist on the store anymore because it's, you know, 'cause the Star Wars thing went away and now you can't buy your Darth Vader anymore or whatever the fuck. Like, here's your Goku. Oh, we sold this number of Gokus and we're not going to sell another Goku ever again, but we'll certainly take a percentage of every Goku sale that players want to do amongst themselves. You know, like that sort of stuff can definitely happen. It happens in some other games and all of that sort of stuff. So I wouldn't be shocked to see them try to do a player-run marketplace if they are going to have scarce digital items that they want players to be able to sell to each other. It's not about players creating things and selling them, I would guess. So you could have like, oh, a player created a skate park and Now they want to sell it to you for 400 skate points or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see how the money part of that ends up coming in when they finally do start talking about it more and more. This person, this anonymous person, didn't mention anything about the gameplay in Skate or anything like that, but I have at this point heard from a pretty wide variety of folks who have been in various Skate play tests and all of that sort of stuff. And I have seen footage, as they say, as the song goes, I've seen footage of Skate. That's the in parentheses. I've seen footage of Skate. You stay noited enough, you get to see the Skate footage. And it looks fucking good. Like, for a game that is obviously, like, super fucking has way more work that needs to be done and is not a final product in any sense of the word, and there's so much more work to be done, and the build that they put out, I don't know, maybe the build that they're working on internally is way further along than what they're showing to people. We don't know, right? But that thing looks like something I want to play a whole lot of. That thing looks fucking great, and I'm excited for Skate to come out, even in light of this. Like, if they want to try to sell scarce digital items and stuff like that, like, I you know, I don't know that that's something that I'm extremely interested in doing, but hey, I want to play that goddamn video game because it looks rad. And I'm, yeah, like I said, I'm very excited to see it. Ben in Boston writes in and says, Bethesda has a track record of releasing janky, buggy games. Do you think the fact that Microsoft owns them now will have any effect on this or other aspects of Starfield? I would love to believe that Microsoft would say, hey, when this thing ships, it's got to be clean. It's got to ship clean. We've got to at least, even if it's not 100% of the way there, it's got to be better than you were last time around and the time before that and the time before that. I would hope, but yeah, I don't know. The game is large. Can you truly QA all of it the old fashioned way? Or do you need to start selling it so that millions of players start breaking it in all these different ways, so you know what else you need to fix? Right. I don't know. I don't know what impact, you know, you could say that, like, hey, if Starfield is going to end up only being on Xbox and PC, that maybe not making a version for PlayStation means there's one less SKU to worry about. And, you know, the development resources are allocated a little differently and so on and so forth. And maybe that has some kind of impact there. I don't know. It could. But, I don't know if I buy it. I don't know if I buy that they'll be able to ship it as clean as it probably should be. Be nice. It'd be nice. Matt in Japan writes in and says, would you say that the worst Mario game is still better than the best Sonic game? Also, what would you consider to be the worst Mario game and the best Sonic game? Worst Sonic, well, okay, no, we're looking for best Sonic game. I'm going to say best Sonic game is probably Sonic Frontiers. Potentially Sonic the Hedgehog 2. But, yeah, you know. And what is the worst Mario game? I mean, probably Mario Teaches Typing. Mario is Missing. Hotel Mario. Super Mario Brothers Special is pretty bad. I love it,
but it's very bad.
Mean Bean Machine, Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine is A, not a Sonic game, it's a Dr. Robotnik game, and B, it's just a Puyo Puyo game. When that game came out in Japan, it was just, it, you know, they just slapped Dr. Robotnik on it and said, yeah, I don't know. And now it's got a license because no one in the U.S. knows what a Puyo Puyo is. Yeah, worst Mario game is Mario Party, right? It's the franchise, probably. If we limit it to games that are like published by Nintendo on Nintendo platforms, and Puyo Puyo is better than Sonic. Yeah, maybe Mean Bean Machine is the right answer here. The worst Mario game. And if we limit it further to the worst mainline Mario game, then it's Sunshine. Right? Kind of has to be Sunshine at that point. Because it ain't Galaxy. It ain't Odyssey. Odyssey ain't the worst Mario game. Is Color Splash a mainline game? I would not consider it to be one. Is New Super Mario Brothers 2 on the 3DS? Is that the answer? I mean, I would probably still rather play that than Sunshine. Yeah, no, I would absolutely 1,000% rather play New Super Mario Brothers 2 than Sunshine. Lost Levels. Lost Levels is good. Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan is a good, crazy game. But the worst kind of like mainline Mario ass Mario game is, I guess it's Sunshine. And fuck that game. I played some of that recently, off and on, over the past year and change, a little bit of Sunshine. And it's so fucking goddamn bad, man. Like, just the, when they let you out into the world and then you're like chasing the fucking shadow, like, ugh. God, what a fucking wreck of a video game. And that's before you even get into the parts of the game where the camera just simply can't stand up to the task at hand, right? I mean, yuck. Is the best Sonic game better than the worst Mario game? I'm gonna say I would rather play, and I guess I haven't played it to completion, so I can't say for sure, but I would probably rather play Sonic Frontiers than Super Mario Sunshine. So I'm gonna say yes, the best Sonic game is better than the worst Mario game. Even skewed down into, you know, the kind of mainline games. Because if we get into the other stuff, then it's like, well, okay, is, you know, are we saying like Sonic the Fighters, the true best Sonic game, is that better than Hotel Mario? Yes, the answer is still yes. The answer, no matter what, is still yes. No matter what restrictions we put on that thing. Okay. I think that's maybe going to do it for emails. I'm just looking through to see if we've got any. Here's a couple more here that came in over the last couple of hours that we'll Holy shit. I didn't know this. I need to try this. That's kind of cool. Daniel from, I guess, Herne Bay in the United Kingdom Says, now that Ganbare Neo Pokécoon got a surprising Western release in Neo Geo Pocket Color Selection 2 after 22 years, that means that it can be nominated for Game of the Year 2022. I did not know that it was in there. I don't think they advertised that, did they? I feel like I looked at the list of that games, list of games in that collection a couple of times. I'm going to go back to the Steam page.
Do I have to type it out? Neo Geo Pocket.
Is it not on Steam? This was on Steam. Is Steam search broken because the sale started?
All right, I'm going to try this one more time. No, nothing's coming up. That's weird because I feel like I own Neo Geo Pocket games on Steam. What happened? Okay, it's all caps and Neo Geo doesn't have a space in it. Right, okay. Of course.
Says here it has, oh man, yeah, fuck, how did I miss that? It's got SNK versus Capcom Card Fighters Clash, Big Bang Pro Wrestling, Biomotor Unitron, which if you like Pokemon with robot parts, give that a look, Mega Man Battle and Fighters, Puzzlink 2, Ganbare Neo Pokécoon, King of Fighters Battle of Paradise, Baseball Stars Color, Pocket Tennis Color, and Neo Geo Cup 98 Plus Color. Yeah, that's the first time. I mean, it's the Japanese version of the game. It's not like, I don't think they translated it, but it's not like there's a ton of text in there anyway. It looks like that they fucking put out Ganbare Neo Pokécoon and goddamn on frickin' Steam. Holy smokes. That's crazy. All right. That's awesome. I need to try that. I mean, it's a $40 collection, which is a little steep, but like at the same time, I really want to take a look at that. That's, I mean, it's just the game, right? I've been playing the game on my Steam Deck in a other way for a while, but, okay, let's go on here. Just kidding, but it's the best emulation of the game that I've seen. Even the TV static transitions and the menus display properly, though it doesn't strictly use the real-time clock like the game on real hardware. Pokécoon isn't stuck at midnight asleep most of the time, like on most emulators that don't have clock implementation. Pokécoon only builds new minigames when he's happy, and then you check the minigame menu and go back out to send him to work happy to increase percentages. You can use the emulator's rewind function to game the system when opening the door to avoid the guests that brighten or disgust him and get the ones that make him happy instead. If there's only bad ones, the game is in an hour of the day that is considered overnight, and you can just quit and come back in. Wow. I'm going to have to try that out. Because, yeah, there's been, that game uses the real-time clock, and it's a weird, it's, I'm trying to describe Ganbare Neo Pokécoon now, and it's sort of a minigame collection, but also sort of a life simulator. You know, there's parts of it that would, you might want to compare to something like Seaman, or like Little Computer People, I guess, technically. But you've got a little guy on your screen and you can interact with him in a variety of kind of ways. But, when he's happy, he'll go off and create mini games for you. And when he's sad, he doesn't. And it uses the real time clock to determine when he goes to work and when he's asleep and all this other stuff. So there's a lot of different, things along those lines. But yeah, I don't know. I'll be interested to see. I'll take a look at this for sure. And see how it differs, because that's potentially exciting. Let's take one last email here. Julian from Albany, New York writes in and says, as I was browsing operator skins on Modern Warfare 2, I noticed a bio button and they are pure gold. Here's a few snippets. Okay. What do we have here? Here is Stiletto's bio.
Headstrong and vindictive, Stiletto became a cop for one reason. Revenge. Already marked with the scar that splits her face, her fellow officers never learned how she came to acquire it, or her intimate knowledge of Italy's organized crime network. Stiletto told them only that her war was a personal one. And her actions backed that up. Stiletto developed a rep as a fearless door kicker, more than willing to get her hands dirty, even if that brought occasional disciplinary action against her. Jesus, these are great. Koenig. Koenig, age unknown, suffers from severe social anxiety. Unfortunately for him, it's hard to go unnoticed when you're the size of the mountain. Bullied throughout childhood, Koenig found acceptance only when fighting an activity at which he excelled. He was assigned to the 1st Platoon as an insertion specialist, serving as a human battering ram to charge through doors. An expert in urban warfare, Koenig once single-handedly took down an AQ human trafficking cell in Berlin when he breached the townhouse out of which they were operating, and, taking point for his team, proceeded to eliminate all 12 of the AQ combatants inside. While the sniper hood concealing his face makes him a terrifying figure, so much so that the rest... And then the bio abruptly stops there. That's great, because that makes it seem like it's even like placeholder in a weird way, too. All right, here's the last one in this email, but now I'm going to have to go read the rest of them. Zero. Sammy was a lover, not a fighter. And what Sammy loved was partying. He spent his days at country clubs and his evening at nightclubs. He lived only for the moment and himself. One night, a terrorist petrol bomb blew a hole in Sammy's world. While Sammy was lucky enough to survive the blast, his sisters were not. Sammy was left wallowing in guilt for dragging them out that night until his uncle suggested that rather than lay around and feel for himself, Sammy go out and do something about the pain he felt. Man, these are fucking amazing. All right. Yeah. That shit is terrible. Now I want to, all right. We're going to very quickly, do I have Steam open? All right, we don't. All right. Maybe another time we will look at some of the other bios in here, because these all seem like something someone wrote a year and a half ago and said, like, don't worry, we'll replace these with better. We'll have someone do a pass on these later. And then no one did that pass. All right. Well, that's amazing. And that's going to do it for emails. Again, podcast@guard.bike is the place for you to send your emails. If you want to send in emails to me for this program, it's Thanksgiving this week, but I don't know that that's going to necessarily have a huge impact on my schedule. We're going to do food on Thursday. But I should be here streaming tomorrow, and I'll probably be here streaming on Friday as well. Splend a Black Friday with yours truly, as we shop for graphics cards. I don't know. That's if I see a 4090 in a position where I can click a button and get it for its actual retail price, I will probably do that, because I want to burn my house down with melting graphics card parts. But other than that, I don't know. I'm not really looking for anything. I don't know that, I bought this fancy camera a while ago, and I don't know that I need much more in the way of gear. Lighting in this room seems okay now that I'm like actually using it, and all that. So I don't know. There's nothing. Can't think of anything else I really need hardware wise. Not that I need a graphics card, but I what if I had one? I don't know. That's a terrible way to think. Maybe if I had that 4090, I could stream Modern Warfare 2 on the PC without OBS being all fucking, well, without OBS. When OBS is open, I'll say it again, Modern Warfare 2 does not run well for me at all. It's very hitchy. It's very all over the place. I don't understand why.
There should be more than enough juice here to make all that happen. But for whatever reason, it just doesn't. It just doesn't. So I've always got to stream the console version, and that's no fun. So, anyway, that's going to do it for me here. Everyone have a good rest of your week. You know, come through and hang out if you're around. Through, here in the States anyway, it's a holiday. On Thursday, and most people get Friday off as a result of that sort of stuff. And, but yeah, you know, I'll probably be around on Wednesday. I'll probably be around on Friday. We'll post updates accordingly, but we'll probably plan to take a look at Evil West, otherwise known as Kanye West. See what that guy's up to. No, and I don't know what else. There's some other games. Maybe we'll just play some more old games. Maybe we'll just look at this American flag with the Limp Bizkit album cover bursting through it that someone sent to my P.O. box with no indication as to who it's from that is here behind me. I forgot it was here, and then I turned around and was like, ah! That was you? Virtual hero in Twitch chat? You monster. We'll be back next week with more. See you then.